This is Ben and Ashley I, Almost Famous, In Depth.
Yeah.
You feel like it sets the tone?
Very 60 Minutes-y.
In Depth has been one of our favorite projects that we've ever done at the Almost Famous podcast. It's actually, I was talking about it the other day, it's probably my favorite project I've ever done since The Bachelor. Here's the reason why. We get to sit for as long as we want, as long as we need, with people from The Bachelor, Bachelorette, talk to them about their life, what they've been through, who they're becoming, who they are, what's made them who they are, any stances they take on life. We just like to dig deep, and then you, the listener, get to know them better. Well, a few weeks ago, we started a poll, and it's ironic in a sense, and I want to tell you why. We started a poll that said, who would you like to hear from in all of Bachelor Nation, and we'll bring them into studio, and we'll do an in-depth with them. Well, we would expect probably from that poll that the most popular person from Bachelor Nation would be chosen. Well, the ironic piece of all this is the person that was chosen does not believe that he is the most popular person. He probably never has believed he is the most popular person. He actually, I think as we talk to him today, will make fun at some point of the fact that he was chosen. He'll make some comment that diminishes it. But the truth is this, Dean Unglert was chosen in a landslide. And I think there's a reason why. It's one, because, yes, Dean is charming, but charm can be deceitful. What Dean is he's deep, he's real, he cares. He doesn't just walk past real situations, he walks into them. And he's had his ups and downs, as we'll talk about on the podcast today. But you get to know Dean because you spend time with Dean. And I think there's a relatability to Dean that has not only made America go, this guy's got something more and I like it, but it also doesn't hurt that he's absolutely beautiful. But he's so much more. Dean, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for putting that last little cherry on top, too. I really appreciate it.
You know, it's always great when somebody gives you a really good compliment that, like, and I think you would appreciate being called real. Mm. And then how, like, much does it make you cringe when somebody's like, and you're beautiful?
Honestly, that was my favorite part about the whole
really?
Little monologue there.
That's sweet.
Because it's like, oh, he's deep. He walks into the situations. And I'm just like, oh, I'm a little uncomfortable. But then you sprinkle on that he's good looking. I'm like, oh, okay, this is all a joke. Now I understand.
Now I know it's true.
Yeah.
Dean, how do we meet?
You and I met for the very first time. Actually, we could have met at a wine store in Low Highlands in Denver. Mm-hmm. I think I've told you this story. I was with my best friend and his girlfriend. We walked in to buy some wine, to watch some, I don't remember, football maybe or something like that. But my season of Bachelorette hadn't aired. In fact, it had just finished filming, and I was in Colorado. I didn't even see you, but my friend's girlfriend was like, oh my God, that was Ben Higgins that just walked by. I was like, oh, we should have said hi, but we didn't get the chance to. I don't remember how we met for the very first time, though.
I think one of the very first times, and this is funny, is I was sitting at breakfast on a date.
Yeah. Well, no, we had known each other at that point, though, because I remember I stopped and I was like, oh, hey, Ben.
Yeah. Well, that's funny that you say it like that. I actually said, Dean, and you kind of like kept walking. You're like, oh, what's up, dude?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And this guy kind of kept going.
Okay, in my defense. So Ben was on a date at breakfast and I was like randomly walking with a couple of friends and I hear my name called and this is like fresh off the show. So like you kind of get that a lot, mm-hmm. you know? And I look over and I see this tall dude. Like, you were kind of like standing in the shadows a little bit.
Yeah.
And you were wearing like a flat billed hat forwards and like low on your head, which I had never really seen you wear anything like that before. And like maybe your facial hair was a little different. And I just didn't know who you were for the first like 30 seconds of talking to you.
It's fine. We're fine. But what's happened with Dean and I is Dean and I, and I'd like to say this, please tell me if I'm wrong. We met and we became friends pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And we got a real friendship, like one that is not, we don't do any events together, really.
No.
Remind me,
I think the first time we met was in Tahoe when we were doing podcast stuff.
It might be. And we got to spend time together. We got to talk about life. And what intrigues me about you is that you're not afraid to talk about some of the, like, the depths of life. You don't run away when somebody wants to bring up something that's heavy.
Yeah. I think sometimes I struggle to feel the empathy that you're able to possess, but I think that... something I've learned as of lately over the past 2 or 3 years or so is leaning into those difficult conversations can be fun and growth oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Something that I didn't really know for a very long time. But yeah, I agree. I think it's fun to have those conversations. You learn a lot about yourself. You got to learn a lot about other people. That's why I'm a little envious. You get to do this in depth on this show with Ashley because I'm like, oh, that sounds like a fun thing to be able to do.
This is a blast.
Yeah.
It makes this feel like it's real. Like this is, there's no agenda to this. I have no notes on where to go with this. It's wherever we want to take it.
Is it hard for, I wonder if this will be difficult for you because you basically know me in and out, right? So you know what questions you want to ask, but also it's not like there's no novelty to you to like learn about me as we go on because you already know everything.
No, that's not true. So here's the thing I told as I was prepping for this. I was talking to a buddy of mine saying I get to do this today. And I said, here's one of the cool parts is how often you get to sit down with your friend, no matter how well you know them, and you get to ask them questions. And they can't run away from it, and they can't turn it back on you because you like to turn it back on me as quick as you can.
Yeah.
But I'm hosting this. Like this is my plane to fly,
sure.
And you've got to stay on board. And so you're going to have to walk through this with me. And so I think I'll get to know or hear things that I've always wondered that it's never been appropriate to ask.
Sure.
You know?
But also bear in mind that the reason that I'm able to open up to you so much is because I'm able to direct the conversation in certain ways and feel comfortable through misdirection like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if me not being able to deflect the conversation back to you will shut me off at all.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's going to be a fun ride. Dean Ungler in studio. Dean, let's dive in right away.
Sure.
You just said something that I think is how I'd want to start this. You said you're unable to feel the empathy that I would be in deep conversations or painful conversations.
Uh-huh.
Take me out of it for a second.
Sure.
Why do you immediately say that about yourself?
That I lack empathy?
Yeah.
It's something that I've kind of become more aware of as time moves on. And it's been kind of a hurdle of sorts in past relationships. I remember I had this girlfriend in college who was like, you like don't feel things. You never feel any sort of way. And I remember I was like watching something on Netflix and I texted her. I was like, hey, I think I just cried. I watched something on Netflix. Like, are you proud of me? And she goes, oh my gosh, things are changing. I don't know. I think that I've just kind of grown numb to that stuff. And it's like hard for me. It's like my viewpoint on life. Like, you know, that foundationally or like our root values are a little different, similar but different, right? Like you get your values from different places that I do. Mm-hmm. And I think part of where I draw my values from, it's like a numbing thing. Like I'm a nihilist, you know, like I don't think that life has any meaning, but I think that the beauty in life not having meaning is that everything has value in it. And so I think like, you know, having conversations with people and getting like to dive into who they are and get to do this in depth, you know, it's like be nice to people because life is meaningless versus you, is you're like be nice to people because it's just like the right thing to do and like you have your like your faith and all that kind of stuff. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I think the product is the same, but the process is a little bit different for us. And I think that the process is different for me is because I've like been through some stuff with my mom, obviously, with my friends and with my family and all that. And I don't want to like ever blame the way that I am because of any of those things. But I think that has obviously like a bit of it's like a bit of a reason for it, right? I don't know.
Your story was, I don't know if you'd say accurately told during your time on The Bachelorette, but you definitely had a story that was told.
Yeah. It wasn't inaccurately told. I mean, obviously, it's like you're not going to have every little crevice and crack of your story shown, right? Like, I'm sure when you were on the show, it's not like it was Ben Higgins. It was a shadow or a shell of yourself, but yeah. I mean, they covered like the main points, you know, like my mom passing, my family kind of falling apart, and that was basically it. But
tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I just, as I've gotten to know you better, I mean, watching those moments back and seeing that now on national television, was it uncomfortable?
It was uncomfortable. It was the first time I had ever like watched myself back, right? So it's always going to be uncomfortable. On top of that, I was drinking to like cope with the discomfort, right? And so I didn't, while we were filming, right? So I didn't necessarily like know exactly how I would come across having been like a little buzzed or something like that, right? Like normally when you're drinking and you're buzzed and you go out to the bars and you like say something silly, like that's the only time that you have to deal with that, right? But when you do it on TV, you have to deal with it a second time when you watch it back. So there was like a little bit of anxiety ridden because I was like, okay, like how is this going to come across? Like, how am I going to look? Like, am I going to be coherent or am I going to like say the right things? Like that kind of stuff. So that was a little anxiety inducing. what's funny is the fourth time around on the TV show, when I didn't drink at all, I felt no anxiety, no stress or anything like that, because I was like, I was completely in control of everything that I was doing and saying. So it's like, I have nothing to be afraid of, you know?
Yeah. I totally get that. When I was The Bachelor, I barely drank at all.
Right. Smart.
And also because I had so much anxiety going into it, I couldn't just, if I drank to cover it up, it'd take a lot of drinks.
And your schedule is exhausting. So you're like, you know, you're going to bed at 2 a.m., waking up at 7 a.m. probably.
It's like a constant hangover.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fun. I watched your season without knowing you. And your story during that time was deeper than any other we've ever seen, I'd like to believe.
No way.
I think the idea of you, I think there was a moment when you laying on the floor of your father's house with Rachel, and everything had kind of fallen out around you during that hometown date, and you were reminiscing on all the things that have happened to lead you to that point. I think there was a moment there where, maybe just because I liked you already, there was a depth to that moment that I felt an emotion that I don't feel watching this show. Like, your life was being displayed in front of you. Things were... What happened during that date would have ramifications past the show. So I want to know from you, I don't know how in the world you end up on this show, but during that, like, as you watch it back, are you glad you did it?
Yeah, I think that in hindsight, I'm super grateful that I did it, because not only have I grown as an individual since the show, the first show that I went on, but also just like seeing myself, like I said, I'm not much of an empath, right? So like, I don't feel things, but that first show that I went on, when I cried for the first time on camera, I was like looking back that night and I was like, oh man, I'm going to be like such a wuss. Like, I shouldn't have cried. I'm so embarrassed. And then I remember one of the producers was like, man, like, people cry. Like, as long as your story touches one person, like, you should consider it a success. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. That's sense, I guess. But then watching it back, I was like so worried my friends were going to like, you know, make fun of me and like whatever, as a guy crying on TV. But even just that small little thing, like, I guess, provided a lot of growth for me to be like, okay, like, it's okay to feel things. It's okay to like be vulnerable and to like be upset and be sad and cry, which I never really felt before. And that's obviously something I'm still working on. It's not like it's going to happen overnight. But that in and of itself, just that first episode where it was Rachel and I in Hilton Head, South Carolina, or North Carolina. I can't remember exactly which Carolina it was. But I remember I cried on that date. I told her about my mom, et cetera. And yeah, I was like worried about it, but then watching it back, like the outpouring of support from everyone, even my friends who were reaching out to me, they're like, because even before that, like before I went on the show, like even some of my closest friends didn't even know that I, you know, lost my mom at a young age or whatever it was. And they watched the show and they're like, holy cow, like, I didn't know this. And it was just something that I'd never really wanted to share with anyone, because I didn't want to feel like receive any sympathy or like preferential treatment because they felt bad for me, something like that, you know? So,
but wouldn't you... Here's the part that, and this is where I want to pause you, this is what I don't get, is wouldn't you want people to fully know you? Like, these are your friends that you're worried about if they're going to make fun of you because you cry, yet they don't know you. Like, getting to know you as a friend is honestly sometimes impossible.
Personally? Or just generally?
Generally,
okay.
I would say.
Yeah.
And like, if your good friends, some of your closest friends don't know that your mom had passed at a young age,
yeah,
something that is a pivotal moment in your life for every reason.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just like, as a 25-year-old guy, you're making new friends. You're like going out. It's just not really something that you bring up in conversation. Or even like, if you have an opportunity to bring it up, it's just not something that I ever really cared to be like, hey, by the way, like, you know, this happened to me when I was 15. Or a big part of it too was I didn't want to receive sympathy or preferential treatment for it. I didn't want to be like liked because of the things that had happened to me. I wanted to be liked because of the person that I am now, not the things that had happened to me in the past, I think. And I just never really took it on myself to be like, yeah, like, this is my story, you know? And a lot of people too, especially me, like, I don't feel like my story is wholly unique. I don't think that my story is like worth sharing. I like kind of like began to turn around on that a little bit. Obviously, having a podcast and meeting people like you, it kind of like makes you feel like every story is special in its own way. Like, sure, it's unique, but every story is worth being heard as well. And that's like taking some time to come around on. But even now, it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, really, I guess, about why I didn't open up about that part of my life, you know? And it was such a long time ago. And it's like, obviously, between 15 and 25 is when I went on the show. those 10 years are like some of the most transformative years of your life. And so I didn't even really associate my current self with my past self when I was 15. So it was just like, there's no point in really diving into that side of it, I guess.
Have you at all resented, because as I listen to you talk here, it's, you know, I get it. I get that when you're 25, you're going out, you know, to the bars, you're meeting new friends. It's not a topic that's going to come up.
Yeah.
But now that it's happened, people know that about you. They know that at a young age, your mother had passed.
Yeah.
Are you at all resentful that that's brought up so often?
Now?
Yeah.
I don't like that people can use it as an excuse for like my behavior or something like that. You know what I mean?
Explain more. Tell me more.
Like, let's say, because I'm obviously, I make a lot of bad decisions in life. I think we all do, maybe more so than others. But sometimes I see the case being made like, oh, he had a hard upbringing, so like, let's give him a pass on this. Mm. You know, I don't like hearing that. I don't necessarily think that just because my mom died when I was 15 or my friend Hunter died when I was 10 or Alex died when I was 21, that like that gives me a pass on anything. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I just think it's kind of, I don't think that excuses any type of bad behavior. You know what I mean? So I guess maybe that's kind of why I stay quiet about it.
That's an anti-victim mentality that you're taking. So like you're saying, don't give me sympathy. Don't lay off of holding me accountable to live, to being a greater person because of the pains of my past.
Yeah.
Though that's not an excuse for you.
I think it's a silly thing to think that it would be an excuse. Like, who would ever want to use that? Like, people use that excuses, yeah, but no one wants that. Like, you shouldn't really have excuses. And B, it shouldn't be for anything that happened to you in the past. Like, I don't know. I just think it's silly. It's like, okay, that was a long time ago. A, B, even if it was, like, that should encourage you to do things maybe better or differently. And so I would never be like, oh, I'm sorry that I did this, but when I was younger, like, this happened to me, and so now I feel this way, and that's what's making me act like this. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I it completely makes sense to me. It's not common.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thought process of don't use my past as an excuse is not common.
I think it should be more common.
Fair.
Yeah.
You can think that, it's just not. Mm-hmm. So when you sit here and you tell me, then let me try to get to the bottom of this. What role did your past in these traumatic situations in your life that did change the course of direction, what role do they play in your life now?
I don't think
they're not an excuse.
I don't think they play any role in my life. I mean, sure, they were of all stepping stones that, like, every time that something happened to me, you have to come out the other side of it. But I don't think that, I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, obviously, I'm a product of all of the experience that I've had as a person, right? And I would be a completely different person had none of those things ever happened. And a lot of the good things in my life that have happened are, in a weird way, like, because of those things, those bad things, right? So I would never say that I'm not who I am because of those things, but they don't have, like, any bearing on my day-to-day life, you know? Like, I don't think they do, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that has always amazed me about you is that your thought process in these moments like this.
Why?
You really do believe that, and it's pretty true for you that you don't use these things that have, like, definitely hurt, that have caused tears, that have caused confusion, that have shaken your worldview up. You don't use those as excuses for what you're doing today. They're pivotal points. They're foundational building stones, as you call them, but they aren't excuses for, hey, because my mom has passed, that's why I am doing XYZ. So I want to shift gears here. Because it's not fair for me, and I don't really know what would be talked about when it comes to these bad decisions. What bad decisions are people talking about when it comes to you that they're dismissing your behavior because of your past?
I don't know. You see a lot of, obviously I've got not the most successful dating history, right? So it's like, I would never, like, now that I'm dating Kaylin, right? I would never, like, if I lose my temper, which obviously doesn't happen very often, if ever, but I would never blame a bad decision on something that happened to me back then because of that. Like, say you lose your temper, right? I'm like, oh, I'm upset, but it's okay because my mom's dead. Like, that's just kind of messed up, you know what I mean? Like, I would never do that. That's kind of what I'm saying, where it's like,
and I think it's why you're voted the one interview that everyone wants to hear, because I think you are unique in that. I don't think you're alone in that, and I don't think you're wrong in it, but I think what intrigues people about you is that mindset. Because, yes, you've done things like we all have that have been considered mistakes, or maybe have hurt people in the process or hurt yourself in the process. But you don't look at those situations, and this is the beautiful thing about having being a friend of yours, is you don't look at those situations and blame anything but yourself. You take ownership for it.
I suppose, yeah.
And everybody out there watching goes, there's something freeing about that that I want to know more about.
Hmm.
And I want to know where that comes from.
I don't know where it comes from. I wish I could know where it comes from.
Confidence?
I don't think there's, I don't know. I don't know if I'm the most confident person in the world. Maybe inwardly, but I don't think I express. I don't know. Do I? Am I confident? I suppose. Maybe sometimes. Tori's nodding her head. Yes, I guess so. I honestly, I really don't know. I haven't really put too much thought into why that is that way. I think, again, it boils back down. So, I mean, when I was a kid, up until I was about 13 or 14, we were pretty like devoutly Presbyterian. We went to Sunday school and Sunday church every week up until my mom got like really, really sick. And we had like this good foundational religious aspect to our family, even though like the kids, as most kids do, they hated going to church on Sundays, but my parents wanted to do it. It was like an hour drive every day, or every Sunday, I'm sorry. And then when I went to college, I kind of like shed all of that, and I became, for like 3 years or something, I was like steadfastly atheist in college, and I was like, God isn't real, all this is just bogus, whatever. I've kind of come around on that a little bit since then, but I think that those years in college, I was kind of just like very heavily nihilistic as well. And I was just like, nothing matters. All of the past is the past. The future is the future. And there's no reason to like let the past have any dictation on your future self. Right. And so I think that's kind of where I took that mentality from. And even in college, like I remember I was dating this girl when I was a sophomore. We had been dating for like 10 months or something like that. And I had just moved into a new house. And with that moving, I had like a shoebox that I had like a bunch of old pictures and stuff in, and like letters and all that kind of stuff that I'd like never told anyone about. And she like was moving with me, and we like opened it together, and she was like, oh my gosh, like I'm finally getting like a peek into you as a child, or like your older, you know, like some of your memories, and like something that I'd never really shared before. I guess that's just, I've never really associated like past self with either present or future self, for better or for worse. Like what you're able to do with your platform is like you're building things, right? And maybe I guess like I'm ashamed of who I am now or who I'm going to be. And so that's kind of why I like kind of keep things under wraps a little bit. I don't know. I guess I haven't really like delved much into that.
If you just notice there, Dean's really good at like quietly turning it back on me for just a second. It's really great. It's a really good skill set he has. But we're not going to let it happen today. We're going to take a break here. And when we get back, I want to talk to Dean. I want to start at the beginning. How in the world... is Dean Unglett who he is? And then also, how does he get on the show? Because it just doesn't make sense. You're going to hear at the end of the podcast an interview with Bob Dalton. Bob Dalton and I both have started small businesses. Part of starting a small business is also hiring the team around you. Actually, when somebody asks me, okay, how do you make a small business work? My response is always, I never make it work. It's the team we have that makes this work. You want to surround yourself with the best people, and that's why I use ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a challenge. As Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner discovered, Gretchen needed to hire a game artist for her education tech company. She knew it wouldn't be easy to find someone to grow with her team. That's why she went to ZipRecruiter. Like Gretchen, Generous also uses ZipRecruiter to help find the most talented of people. In fact, before Generous even started, I was using ZipRecruiter. I was on ZipRecruiter to help me find jobs. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Gretchen posted her job on ZipRecruiter, and she said she was so impressed with how quickly she found qualified applicants. She also uses ZipRecruiter's screening questions to filter her candidates, so she could focus on the best ones. And that's, yes, that's how Gretchen found a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. Hey, I'm telling you, if you want to hire the best employees and surround yourself with the best people, ZipRecruiter is the way to do it. With results like this, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified, quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Ben. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEN. ZipRecruiter.com/Ben. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Coming back with Dean Unglert. Dean, Let's start at the beginning. You're raised in Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah.
Right?
More Basalt, Colorado, but Aspen's the nearest town that everyone knows, you know?
Close enough.
Yeah.
And pretty normal childhood.
Yeah, I suppose.
Talk about it. That is it's not convincing. I don't know if I know your childhood very well at all.
Where do you want to start with the childhood exactly?
Let's start at 7.
Well, I was 6, Ben. Okay, so a little backstory for the listener out there. I confided in Ben a story that I have only just recently started opening up about. Actually, not too long ago, at Ashley and Jared's wedding, I think was the first time I told you about it.
It's one of the best. I'll help you here, though. You tell yours, I'll tell mine.
Well, and so I was going to say that one of the reasons that I was able to open up to Ben about this was because he is obviously as warm and welcoming as he is. Not only was he like receptive and empathetic, but he also had a very similar story of his own to share back with me, which only just helps us connect on a deeper level, I think, right?
I don't want to diminish how great this podcast is going to be getting to know you. I have a feeling that this will be the segment that gets the most response.
My heart's beating a little faster than it normally does right now. I've thought about this story a lot, and I thought about how, if I ever decide to share it publicly, how I would go about doing it. I never thought that I'd be sharing it on a podcast with you.
Oh, let's do it.
So I was bullied a lot in high school and middle school for one very specific reason. And I've only just started sharing this story probably within the past year or so. I would say December 2018 was the first time I started sharing this story. So less than a year, actually. And some of my closest friends know about it. My current girlfriend knows about it. Ben obviously knows about it. Ben's girlfriend knows about it. And you know what? F*** it. I'm just going to share it anyways. I don't know if we can curse on this one. Let's go ahead and bleep that out.
100% you can.
So I was bullied a lot in middle school and in high school because of an event that happened to me when I was 6 years old. I hurt myself in a way that's very specific to how only a man can hurt himself. And I didn't have the courage to stand up for myself later on in life to the people that would then bully me for that event. So it was first grade. It was recess. We had this like suspension bridge on the playground, and on the sides of the suspension bridge, obviously were like these, ropes to hold the bridge in the air. And one of the ropes came undone somehow throughout the wear and tear of a normal day. They were attached at the bottom by these little hooks that would like hook on to the bridge. And so Mark's already kind of getting to it a little bit.
Easton's not even looking anymore.
And so as a 6-year-old, curious, adventurous, excited, I put my foot on the hook to like swing back and forth and beat my chest like Tarzan swinging through the jungle. And sure enough, that hook was small. My foot was small. Didn't have very good grip. Slipped off. This bridge was probably, I want to say, 7 feet in the air. I was, 3 feet tall. So it was a tall bridge. And the hook, instead of finding anywhere else to fall, it decided to go right up between my legs, hook onto the thing that carries the two things that define us as men, and ripped up just about to just below the end of that other thing that
end of his penis. Us. It literally ripped all the way up to the end of his penis.
From his scrotum to the end of his penis.
Yes. Ripped it.
Oh,
so
my
about,
God.
If we're using those words, sure. From about halfway on my ball sack to about three, just below the tip of my penis.
About 6 inches from the tip of his penis. So like,
Let's just say it was a big
half
cut.
Half of the way up
it
to
was
the top.
Oh, it was a big cut. Yes. And so obviously as a 6-year-old, I run to the doctor. I'm like screaming. I'm crying. I have no idea what to do. So I like hobble, run all the way up to the nurse. And she goes, this is way over my head. I got to figure out what to do with this.
Oh my God, a school nurse, please.
So she calls my mom. I'm like laying in the nurse's office. My mom comes and she's like, okay, well, we've got to like bring you to surgery. So I go to like the nearest surgeon and they stitch me up. I think it was like 40 or so stitches in my penis from my scrotum to the up the shaft of my penis down to just below the head. Everything was fine, obviously. I was a 6-year-old, so I don't remember the pain too much. I remember like some of the side effects, like having to gauze it every so often. My mom had to like take care of me, clean me, make sure it was like disinfected. And for the longest time, I was like, this is the worst thing that ever could have happened to me. Like, I'm deformed. I'm so abnormal. Everything was fine. Like, my penis and scrotum are perfectly fine. I just got like kind of a gnarly scar down there. You know what I mean?
Were you able to urinate normally?
Oh, I don't remember. I think so.
You remember, need a catheter for an extended period
of
time?
No, I definitely didn't need a catheter. I remember one specific story. We were like went on vacation somewhere, and this hotel had a pool, and I really wanted to go to the pool, but I obviously wasn't allowed in the water because I had this open wound on my testicles. And I remember like hobbling, running down the hallway for a long time. My brother, I don't know. It was just this very distinct memory that I have. But as kids do, they like to obviously like create stories and start rumors. And what they did was they kind of started this rumor that I only had one testicle for a long, long time. Mm. And it didn't really matter much when I was in elementary school or middle school that this rumor was going around that I had one testicle. But then when I got to high school, when testicles become an important thing, right, the rumor became that I only had one testicle still when I was in high school. And everyone, like, joked about it, like, behind my back and some, like, very rarely brought it up to my face, but it happened a couple of times. And I was always, like, so, like, ashamed and taken it, like, I couldn't defend myself because I just, like, wasn't confident enough to be like, I've got two testicles and I, like, everyone needs to know it. You know what I mean? And so I was bullied pretty heavily for that. And on top of that, I had like a very attractive, my sister is very attractive and they always like bullied me for that. And then I like, because of, I don't know if it was because of the stitches that I got on my scrotum or I had a couple of knee injuries as well, but I walked really funny. And so everyone in high school, well, not everyone, like the upperclassmen when I was playing football, they would always say that I walked around like I had a dildo up my ass. And so because of these things.
And he didn't.
And so I did not have a dildo up my ass. And this was the story that Ben and I bonded over because Ben, I think, has maybe shared it on this podcast or Almost Famous, but he has a similar-ish story. But I just want to be clear.
Wait. Not similar in the hook to the genitalia.
Yeah, not the second part. I was going to say.
Oh, and also, I think I might have shared this on the Help I Suck at Dating podcast, but when I moved to Los Angeles, one of the first things I did was to get my potency checked. Mm. And what I said was on the podcast the first time was that I wanted to, you know, I just wanted to see how I was doing down there just out of curiosity. But the reality of it is, I just wanted to know if, like, the stitches or, you know, the rusty hook that just cut my penis open maybe, like, inhibited my ability to have children.
Gave you a vasectomy. I mean, who knows?
Right. Long story short, it didn't. Like, everything's fine down there in that sense. But that's always, it was always.
You're not going to send pictures out if anybody's like, yeah, send pics. No, that's
I'm
not funny.
I'm curious about the scar.
I can show you. Well, I won't, but I could.
I got really excited for that. Is it that noticeable?
No, it's not. And no one, you wouldn't, of all the girlfriends I've ever had, no one ever knew about it until I finally just started talking about it a year ago, right? And yeah, I think like talking about it has kind of like released some of the power that it's had on me. The thing is, like a lot of the kids from high school with like some of my best friends from high school still think that I probably only have one testicle.
Let's make it clear. You have two.
I have two testicles and they both function as testicles should function. I guess I can share this story. Like the reason, the first time I ever opened up about the scar on my penis, is when Leslie and I were dating. Leslie, of course, had a double mastectomy and she has scars on her breast because of that. And I was like, look, you're not that different than me. I've got a scar on my genitals as well. And let me prove it to you. And so that's how I started. That was like the first time I told the story to someone.
What was her response?
She was like, why are you so freaked out about this? Like if your penis is perfectly normal. That's kind of weird to talk about my penis in the context of my ex-girlfriend.
Really getting in depth in this one.
That was the first time I ever shared the story with anyone, right? And so then then I would like kind of get drunk with some of my best friends and be like, hey guys, I've got a funny story to tell you about my penis. And obviously they're like, yeah, tell us. This is going to be great.
Yeah. And was I the first ever go? I think I don't have one that one-ups it.
It's on the same level though. And you were the first one to ever rebuttal with a story of your own, which I really appreciate. And I mean, if you want to give us like a...
I would love to.
Yeah.
Does that make you feel better?
Yes, please.
This is a great segment. Yeah. We're gonna skip all of Dean's childhood just for this segment.
But I guess the point of that story was that was something that I was centrally bullied for a lot as a kid, right? The thought that I had a testicle.
Isn't it funny that, it's not funny, isn't it odd that some of those stories like that we maybe like suppress and hold deep and like laugh about now a little bit are the ones that have affected us the most as we've grown up.
Right.
This story that I'm about to share did suck my confidence away. Okay, so here it is. I'll tell it in a quick version. Later on, we'll record a longer version of it. I was, so freshman year of high school, I got called to be the starting quarterback. It's a big deal. Two injuries. It wasn't because I was great. It was two injuries. I got to step up. And I had a great first game. It was awesome. It was fun. I thought like the future is in football. Sophomore year, I'm supposed to start again, obviously. The senior class had graduated. And so I have a shot to be the starter. All of a sudden I start feeling like just a pain in my testicles, like a soreness, a heat, like just like it throbbed all the time. So I'd reach down there and I was feeling just in case there was something going on. And I felt a clump, like a clump of something in my testicles. And so I told my parents and they took me to the doctor. I went to the doctor and the doctor diagnosed me with something called a varicocele, Varicose seal is something very common. 1 in 4 men get it. Not every, I think it's 1 in 8 that need to get it removed. But mine was big enough that I need to get it removed. What a varicose seal is it's an extra like vein in your sac that heats, that blood comes through, obviously, and it overheats your testicles. And so it would kill off your sperm. So if you leave it for long enough, actually your sperm will stop producing and you'll become sterile. So you need to get it removed at some point soon. Well, mine started to get so bad and so sore that I did it a couple months before football season thinking I'll get this done, I'll get it cleared up, and then I'll be good to go for football. It's an easy surgery, actually. They just go in through your groin, arthroscopic. They pull it out, cut it up, cauterize the ends. You don't even hardly know it happened, and within 2 days, you're back to going. So all that's going really well for me. I go in for surgery. I come back home. I remember this. I'm laying on my bed in my house, and all of a sudden, my nuts just start hurting so bad after surgery.
Eesh.
And at the time, I thought maybe it was because I just had surgery on my testicles. That would make sense, right? But they start hurting so bad, and they start burning. And I call my dad in. It's been about 24 hours since surgery, and I said, Dad, I need you to look at these. It hurts so bad. And so I lifted up my sheets or whatever, and he looked, and he's like, we need to get you to the doctor right now. My ball had swollen up to the size of like a grapefruit.
Oh, my gosh.
And we didn't know why. So I had a massive testicle. And I go into the doctor, and this is what the doctor does. Literally what happened was the vein that they're supposed to cauterize together did not cauterize completely, and so blood was just pumping directly every time my heart would pump into my testicle. And so they had to take a needle, a drainage needle, and shove it right into my ball sack without numbing me because it was getting so big so fast and start draining the blood and the liquid off of my ball sack, like as I'm wide awake.
And non-numbed.
Non-numbed.
Right.
Well, my swelling doesn't go down for a few days. And so I go back to high school, and because of the damage that's been done down there, and it was a lot of damage. You know, they had to go back in, re-cauterize. They had just stuck a needle in my testicles. Like, that's a lot of, like, trauma to a place that's, like, really sensitive. It stayed swollen, and I had to go back to high school, and I had to sit on ice in every class. I couldn't miss more class, and so I had to sit on ice. So I had to carry an ice bag around and sit on it, where you can't hide that in class. And so people would ask, what's happened? What happened? Well, it got to the point where I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to start showing like people my testicle. So I showed the football team like why I wasn't practicing. And I showed the basketball team like why I wasn't going to the open gyms. Like, here, check out my testicles. And they did. And I'm not kidding. Like, it's still to this day, it was something that was brought up every time. I was like, I had a deformed testicle that was the size of a grapefruit for probably 2 weeks of my life.
Jeez.
In class. So that's why Dean and I related on that. So at that point,
that's that story.
So at that point, Dean and I are sitting around having drinks at Ashley and Jared's wedding going, I knew I liked you and I knew there's a reason why, but I got made fun of it for it too. And it really did affect me. And I think a little bit of my confidence. I don't know if you felt this way, but the fact that every underlying story about, I felt like everybody was talking about it behind my back.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I thought that I was going to be a virgin for my entire life.
Mm.
I was like, no one's ever going to want to sleep with me.
Well,
okay.
As we'll talk about later, that hasn't been the case.
Okay. And what's funny is I remember when I hooked up with my girlfriend for the first time, she spent a lot of extra time down there, like examining, like feeling around, making sure everything felt normal, because she had obviously heard the stories and she was like, okay, well, I'm going to spend a little bit of time, you know, figuring it out. But yeah, I would wake up as like a 13. I lost my virginity when I was 16, I think. I'd wake up almost every single day before that happened. I was like, I'm going to be a virgin forever. No one's going to want to like have sex with me. This is the worst thing in the world. How could this happen to me of all people? Like, this sucks. And then obviously I lost it. And then I like began to realize like there's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah.
I just like I created this thing in my head where like, I don't know, I let this have some power over me in a weird way.
There's about 4 or 5 health stories from my high school days, middle school and high school days, that have like dramatically affected my life. We'll talk about them at some other point.
Four or five?
Oh, there's some wild ones, man. And we'll talk about it at some other point, but not today. But that is my best story with our nuts.
With your testicles.
Hey, before Dean, I really want to dive into your childhood and some of the parts that mean the most. But before we do, let's take one break and we'll come back to re-chat with Dean. If you've been listening to the show for any amount of time, you know and you've heard of us talking about Framebridge. They make it super easy and affordable to frame your favorite things, from kids' art and concert posters to vacation photos sitting on your phone. Here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your photo, or they'll send you packaging to safely mail in your physical pieces. Preview your item online in any frame or any style. Choose your favorite or get free recommendations from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. Instead of hundreds, you pay at framing stores. The prices start at $39, and all shipping is free. I'm telling you, people, years ago when I bought my house, I got pictures framed, and it was in the hundreds of dollars, upper hundreds. It's not cheap. So I'm telling you right now, if their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free, it's ridiculous if you don't consider it. Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use our code AlmostFamous. The holidays are right around the corner, and this is the perfect gift to give a family member or friend. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code AlmostFamous. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code AlmostFamous. Framebridge.com, promo code AlmostFamous. A lot of scrotum talk today on the podcast. That's actually a fantastic segment because it's so real, it's so true, and it really did, it really did affect us. I mean, honestly, ever since you told me this story, I can't get over the idea that there's a hook that just dolly ripped apart your undercarriage.
Well, yeah.
Dean, with that, we're going to transition. There's no easy way to do this. What are your happiest moments growing up?
My happiest moments growing up. That's a great question, actually. I don't know, though. My childhood started off kind of weird, where we like lived in an RV park up until I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I have like some distinct memories from the RV that were pretty wholesome. Like I remember sitting on top of our it was a bus, right? So my dad like gutted a school bus and put a bunch of beds into it, and we lived in that for like 4 years. I distinctly remember like one time we sat on top of this bus and like watched some demolition derby while we were eating Oreos at night in some like town in Oklahoma or something weird like that. Like that was a good memory. As a kid, like older wise, I don't know. It was basically, it was a normal childhood, except aside from obviously all those other things, you know what I mean? Like I remember we had an Easter in Steamboat where like my mom hid candy around the apartment that we were staying in, like the hotel room or something like that. I remember like spending a lot of time with my brothers and sister, like looking for them, like having fun, and the snow was falling outside, and we're like in this cool, exciting new place. So just like small things like that. But I don't remember anything like specific that's like that was like the happiest moment of my life, you know?
Do you think your family would look back on Dean as a kid and say, we knew this is who he was going to become?
What have I become, I guess, is the question.
Well, you're living in a van.
Yeah.
You have a lot of wanderlust. Yeah. You're an artist. You do incredible videos.
Oh, man, thanks.
And you can be kind of this like artist, wanderlust figure, and also... I can't say it any other better way. Like, do really well on reality television.
Yeah, in some weird way.
Yeah.
What's funny is the first time I went on the show, my best friend was like, dude, you're going to suck on that show. Like, you're way too normal for it.
Mm.
And I guess the more I think about it, the more I'm like, I hope I'm not normal. You know what I mean? And what's funny about the living in a van thing is I'm actually in the majority of my family for living in a van. My brother lives in his truck. My father lives in an RV. My sister and other brother both live in like home, like an apartment. So 3 out of 5 of us live in a car. Essentially, so I'm not wholly unique in my family specifically. I don't think that they would look at me and think that at all, but like, I don't know. Interesting story about both my brothers are older, but the second brother, right? None of us in our family are like really good at communicating our feelings, especially as it comes to like being brothers with each other, like how much we mean to each other. Just a weird thing for brothers to do. On top of that, we're just weird people to begin with. And I remember my brother's girlfriend and I were like, we were all going out, me, my brother, his girlfriend, my other brother, and both of my brothers went upstairs because they forgot something. So it was just like me and my brother's girlfriend were like waiting for them downstairs. I remember she said something to me. She was like, Ross, the other day told me how special you are. And he was like, he told me that Dean possesses all of my good qualities and none of my bad qualities. And I was like, wow, I would never expect Ross to say that. Like, he would never say that to me, just me and him talking, you know what I mean? So it was like a cool third party way to like find out that, I don't know, my brothers thought highly of me, which I've never really thought. I would never think they thought lowly of me, you know what I mean? But like, it was just like this, an interesting thing to hear that I really appreciated. But no, I mean, I don't think anyone would ever expect or have suspected this. I was always kind of this weird black sheep where like I was the only member of my family to have like an office job as a recruiter. Like I sat at an office for, or at a desk for 40 to 50 hours a week. And all my other brothers are like, or siblings are like, you know, my sister's a hairstylist. My brother's a waiter. My other brother's a carpenter. My father's a carpenter. So it's like, I don't know why I felt like this need to kind of have like a more of a normal life at first. Obviously reality TV kind of derailed that normalcy a little bit, but yeah, I don't know.
If childhood wasn't full of like the happiest memories, then what are some of the hardest?
Childhood was not full of the, well, obviously the story about my balls is not the best story.
You have to bring it back up.
When I was 10, my best friend got hit by a truck. That was like the first experience of trauma that I was kind of had to deal with. He was my best friend. His name was Hunter Holly Scott. He and I shared a birthday, April 17th, 1991. And you know, when you're that age, like that's like a big deal. And it's like, it's like enough of a reason to like become best friends with someone. And we were neighbors. We lived pretty close to each other. So we spent a lot of time together. But yeah, we were best friends. And then one summer we were both like riding our bicycles to the market, and we had picked up like some drinks and some snacks, and we were riding back. And as I was riding, we were riding back. He was like maybe 10 feet in front of me. And he lost his balance and he fell over into the street. And as he fell over into the street, a truck came and ran him over, like ran his head over. It was pretty graphic. So that was my first brush in with trauma, right? When I was 10 years old. And I actually remember, funny enough, to kind of bring this back to what we were talking about earlier, is I was sitting there as a 10-year-old on the side of the road. Like my best friend's brains were basically spilled out into the street. At this point, they had thrown a tarp over it. They were like trying to contact both of our parents. But I remember I was sitting there there's like a crowd starting to gather from like the cul-de-sac, because it was like, you know, pretty close-knit community. And they all like come around me and they're like, are you okay? Are you okay? And I remember crying. And I remember the only reason that I was crying was because I felt like I was expected to be crying. Like I felt like people thought, they were like, Dean should be crying right now. So I was like, I'm going to cry. Like I'm going to make it. But then I remember thinking to myself, I was like, there's nothing I can do about this situation. So what's the point of crying? You know what I mean? But I was like performing, right? I was like performative crying. I was like, I think I'm supposed to be sad here, yeah. So I'm going to cry. And I was sad, of course, but like I felt like I wasn't necessarily visually as upset until I was like, oh, like I probably should be crying right now. You know what I mean?
How do you process that as a 10-year-old?
I don't think I ever really did, to be perfectly honest. I remember my parents were super, like, obviously they were there. My mom was like super supportive. She was like, I'll do like whatever I need to do to like make this better for you. And then they were like, we're going to like set you up in therapy. So I went to therapy a couple of times, but I like hated it. And so they, I was like, I asked them, and I was like, I can't do therapy anymore. Like, pull me out of therapy. I think I did like 2 sessions. And then just kind of like, I just kind of buried it and forgot about it for a long time. And like, I still don't really think about it often. Like, I was 10 years old, so my memory isn't like super strong from those times. I remember he was my best friend, and I remember like obviously the visual of it happening. But what's funny is then that fast forward 12 years, when I was 22, when my best friend overdosed. He was found dead in a bathtub the day that we were supposed to drive to Connecticut together. And as an adult, like obviously I had maybe like matured a little bit, grown, processed my emotions more. That death hit me a lot harder than I think even like the death of my mother, because I was just like older, and I guess felt things more deeply. And so that one was pretty challenging. We had like a wake or whatever. We all like got together to like commemorate our friend Alex. And I remember I went up there to give a speech in front of like 30 of our friends, and I like broke down and started like crying like uncontrollably, which is pretty uncommon for me, especially as it pertains to that kind of trauma. Like I remember at Hunter's funeral, I was like running back up and forth, like giving speeches about some great like memories that Hunter and I had together. And I was like smiling and like laughing and having fun with it, because like I was remembering the good times, right? But then with Alex, like I wasn't able to do that, and I just kind of like broke down and like couldn't even get words out, sort of thing. And with my mom, it was a little bit different. Like obviously like my family was super close with her, but we didn't have like, it wasn't like I was like giving speeches to my, like not speeches, but like talking to my friends about things. It was kind of more just like me processing everything internally. So like the death at 10 with Hunter was hard, but then the death at 15 for my mom was super hard. But then the death at 22 for Alex was like probably the hardest. At least on the surface, like at least like emotionally. Obviously, the death of my mom was probably the most influential. But I don't know.
Death definitely has a massive impact in all of our lives, but especially yours, at three separate segments, at three separate pivotal like years of your life.
Yeah, it's weird that it came at like very, very different times, right? I don't know.
How has that affected you?
I don't know. I never really think about it. I think it numbs
me. You
have
to think about it.
Like, remember when I said earlier, like, I think I struggle with empathy because I just, like, I know that I've been through a lot of those bad things. And even when I was, like I said, when I was 10 years old, I was sitting there. I was like, why am I crying? There's no point for me to cry because I can't change anything. So, like, when I see something bad happen or when someone comes to me and they're like, hey, this happened and I'm really sad, I can be like, okay, well, I can, like, help you through this and I want to help you through this. But in the back of my head the entire time, I'm thinking, like, just, like, get over it because, like, it's done with. And the only thing that you can now control is your reaction to it and, like, your state of mind and your well-being moving forward. So there's no point really in dwelling on those negative things that happened in the past. And I go back and forth on to whether or not that's, like, a good thing or not. Like, to be able to, like, look back and cry. Like, sometimes I'll, like, look back on my mom's passing and, like, cry a little bit and just, like, be, like, feel good after, like, a nice cry. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I think, like, overall, I don't try to let it affect me too much. And, like, my advice for people, as, like, calloused as it might sound, is just to be like, yeah, just, like, think happier thoughts. You know what I mean?
No, I don't. Because I don't think that's always an option.
But it is, though. That's kind of the point, is, like, that's really the only option, is to deal with things. Like, yeah, you can like dwell on it and like let it affect you negatively for the longest time. But at the end of the day, like that's just time wasted dealing with those negative thoughts, unless you're actually growing from the thoughts, right? Unless you're actually like sitting down and processing things and then being like, okay, like this sucked. I'm going to remember like all the positive times and all the good memories and try to like make them proud through my life moving forward. But if you're like having consistent negative thoughts about something like that, then the only thing you really can do is be like, okay, well, I'm just going to change it around and be positive about it. You know what I mean?
I would imagine what I'm thinking through right now is, though, when you do leave, and I get Hunter played a huge role in your life, but you were 10,
mm-hmm.
and like life at 10 is a lot about having fun.
Pretty
and,
simple, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. But as you lose your mother and then Alex, there's huge pieces of your life that now are being taken.
Mm.
It's not so simple, and there's a value that they held in your life that is now gone. How do you look at those? How do you replace those things? Do you replace them?
I don't think you replace them. I think that Malcolm Gladwell, obviously, is a great author. I can't remember which book it was that he wrote. I think it was Tipping Point, perhaps. But he said something along the lines of, no child is aware of how unique their situation is. And because every child thinks that their childhood is exactly like everyone else's. You know what I mean? So like when I'm 10, I think like everyone else is going through the same stuff I'm going through, and my situation isn't unique. When I'm 15, I think the same thing. I think like my life is just my life. And it's not like wholly unique in any sort of way. But yeah, you're right. I was obviously much more affected, practically speaking, by the death of my mom than I was by obviously Hunter or Alex. That kind of like turned the world upside down in a lot of ways. But again, I was just like dealing with it. Like you haven't really no choice but to just put it all aside and figure it out as you go, you know?
Yeah. And I think though those moments, though, Dean, are like the ones that always feel like they hit the hardest. They're the hardest to process, but they're the things that connect us the most. So there's a lot of people out there listening that have obviously related with you because of the deaths of friends or close family members. And I think your story is one that they listen to and sit on. I would imagine anxiously going, how do you do it? Like, how do you continue to move forward in the midst of great pain? And great sorrow. And to those people that are saying that and looking at you as that figure to help them respond, what would you say?
Well, I just don't think you really have much of another option. It's like if you're not moving forward, then you're standing still or moving backwards. And it's like, well, do you want to look back and be like, okay, well, I just wasted all that time feeling sorry for myself, feeling sorry for the people around me, feeling sorry for my situation, or did I use that time to figure it out and kind of grow from it? And it's like, obviously, it's easier said than done. There were like some pretty dark times when I was like between 15 and 18. I like basically lived by myself. Like my dad kicked my brothers out of the house and then he was gone all the time, either traveling for work or visiting I think his mom was sick in New Jersey at the time. And so I spent a lot of time alone in a house made for six people, right? Which is just a weird, eerie situation. but I never felt like it never felt like a challenge, you know what I mean? Because it just felt, it was just what it was. And so that's why I'm saying I struggle with empathy, where it's just like, I can't really put myself in those shoes, because I just felt, I've always felt like whatever you're given is like the hand that you're supposed to be playing. And because of that, like, you just kind of find a way to make that hand a winning hand. You know what I mean?
Do you ever feel resentment then?
Towards who? Myself?
Life? I mean, if you're sitting there and you look around, you go, I at 10 years old had to witness my best friend get hit on the side of the road. I've lost my mother at a young age. And at 22, I lost my best friend.
Yeah.
I can move forward, but what I would feel, and this maybe is just me, is a resentment. I would still move forward.
Mm.
That can happen.
Mm.
But I would carry on this kind of like chip on my shoulder saying, this isn't fair.
I think the death of my mom really, really brought that side out of me, where I was like, this is bullshit. Like, this doesn't make sense. This isn't fair. The testicle story was a big one too. I was like, this doesn't make sense. Like, why me? Why me of all people was I chosen?
Yeah, it's a funny story, but it like really did hurt. Like, you,
oh yeah.
Like, emotionally.
I thought my life was like transformed in a negative way forever.
Mm-hmm.
More so than, because I was young, I didn't know any better. But with my, my mom too, it's tough losing a mother or a parent, especially obviously losing anyone is difficult, but like a lot of my friends that I was like super, super close with in high school, like they all had families that were like super tight, and they were always super supportive. They're like, if you ever need anything, like you can come to us and ask for it. But I think that's kind of a reason why I kind of didn't really ever feel the need to share my story post college or anything like that, like in adulthood, was because no one really understands until they experience it. And so my friends, the people that I was friends with in high school, they all had like very well-off families. Everyone was wealthy. Everyone was happily married. They didn't really deal with much adversity in their lives. And so I didn't feel comfortable sharing my story with those people because they didn't get it. You know what I mean? And so I kind of just swept it under the rug and kind of kept quiet about it for a long time, until obviously Bachelorette, when I shared it with however many people watched it, Bachelorette. But yeah.
And it wasn't just the story of your mom that was brought out. There is this massive storyline that I know you don't like, but your dad was also highlighted then, because there's been this disconnect then that was at least portrayed during the show there.
Yeah. Well, what's funny about my old dad situation is it's like, I've never really put myself in his shoes. I've never really considered what it was like to lose your wife at 50 years old. He's never cooked a meal in his life for anyone. Like, he's never had to take care of anyone. He just made money and like funded our family for my mom to take care of us, right? So it's not like he knew any better than to do what he did, which was basically disconnect and do what he thought was best. And like, he even ask him now, he doesn't think he did anything wrong, and I think he really believes that he didn't do anything wrong. But from my perspective, he did everything wrong. But that doesn't make what he did wrong. You know, he was just dealing with it the only way that he really knew how. And that's only something that I've kind of come around on recently, where it's like, I can't really blame the guy for bailing out when I was 15 or whatever, because that was like his way of dealing with his traumatic loss of his wife that he's been married to for the past 30 years. Sure, I always kind of considered like the loss of my mom to be like this weird a thing, obviously, but like I always kind of wish that it brought our family closer together rather than like it was kind of acted like a bomb that like put us all further apart. And with my dad specifically, yeah, like him and I had this weird dynamic on the show. And I remember being in high school and going to school every day, and like I got in trouble a lot. I was like always, I was like the one obviously responsible for getting myself to school, which means I was late basically every single day, which means I was in detention and in suspension, et cetera, all the time. And I remember a couple of times the principal would like pull me aside and be like, what's the deal? Like, should we get your dad in here to like talk about this? And I remember always being like, no, I hate my father. I never want to be like him. Don't even talk to him. Like, I don't even want to be part of this conversation. And I was just like so vehemently like, my dad sucks. I hate him so much. I hate him so much. And eventually like the principal would be like, okay, like I won't tell your father. Eventually, obviously, they'd tell my father, and it just like kind of continued to drive a wedge between us. And there were like moments where we would like put things aside, bygones be bygones. Like, my father drove me out to my university to visiting weekend, where you go check out, make sure you want to go to school there. So like we like had salvaged the relationship like weirdly a couple times. But ultimately, it ended up falling back apart. I think it's just like the Unglert curse, where we can't really stay communicative with each other, and we don't really stay in touch with people. And then through high school, through college, we were never really close. And then
like when I moved to LA, I saw him for a couple of days before I moved to Los Angeles. 2 years later, I go on the show, and I hadn't really talked to him since seeing him on my way from Denver to LA. I like stopped by for like a day and like hung out with him. But then since then, like it was 2.5 years between that and going on The Bachelorette. Hadn't talked to him, hadn't seen him or whatever. And I knew going into that hometown that he was going to act like everything was like hunky-dory, everything was A-okay. And I was like so deep in my own shit too, where I was like, you know what? I'm just going to call him out for it right now on national television, which in hindsight probably wasn't the best idea. But I was just like, I didn't like the necessarily the facade that was being put on, that like we're like a loving family, that we all like looked out for each other, and that we all like were just super tight-knit, because we weren't. And then the second I saw him like try to pretend that we were, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to like lean into this and be like, this is just isn't right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that whole experience on the show. What's funny is like my dad loves the experience on the show. You know, like he'll even be like, yeah, dude, you were a f***ing asshole to me on the show. But it was the best experience of my life.
Why?
He's a narcissist. Just like me, just like my brothers, just like my sister. He loves the attention that the show gave him for however much time it gave it to him. Good or bad, like he just like loved being in the spotlight, quote unquote, for that short amount of time. I would like to think that I don't reach that level of narcissism. I hope I don't. But yeah, he's got a funny mentality on it. And like we've obviously like repaired our relationship to some extent between then and now. Like he helped me rebuild my van and build out the living quarters of it a little bit. I like see him maybe like once or twice a year, two or three times a year now. And there's not really any love lost. Like he's getting older, and I know that at some point he's going to die before I die, hopefully. Like that's how it works. You obviously want your kids to outlive your parents. And I don't want to live with the regret of not having a better relationship with my father after it's no longer to be had. Like after I can't, you know, salvage anything. So, I go back and forth, and like, I try to make it work, and you know, obviously he lives his life, I live my life. And whenever we get together, it's like him kind of catching me up on all of his things and him talking the whole time. And it's great. And we like to see each other, but then it's just like a reminder like, okay, yeah, I'll see you again in 6 more months or 12 more months or however long it is. It's just like, you know, obviously people kind of grow apart, I guess.
Would there have been an option to bring the family together? Like because of the passing of your mom, was there ever a pivotal point where it did kind of break the family apart?
Well, I think that just the actual passing of it. So my brothers and my father all butted heads constantly. My dad was like an alcoholic for a long time. He's since been sober for, I think, like 10 years or something like that. But for a long time, he drank a lot. And I think that like tensions were high because, you know, my brothers were like maybe like 18 to 23 or 24 living in the house. And my dad was like, you guys like need to like move out, like get your own place, figure it out, get your life together sort of thing. And that like kind of created some tenacity between the three of them, more so one of my brothers than the other. But that was kind of a challenging thing too, because it's like one of my brothers was like my best friend, and like he, you know, I like respected him a lot, and I liked him a lot. And then to see him and my father get in such heated arguments with each other, I was like, well, I love my brother, and he's like, he's my role model essentially. And if he's fighting my dad, then I should probably fight my dad too. And like, you know, it's just kind of one of those things where it was like a slippery slope or like a snowball effect where things just kind of got progressively worse for no one was at fault for any of it. You know what I mean? It just was one of those weird things.
I hear all of this, and one of the, you know, we mentioned it at the beginning of the podcast, one of the criticisms that you get the most, that you're not unfamiliar with, is Dean's got to grow up.
Yeah.
You know what's really interesting after I hear all this is it made sense to me is you grew up at a really young age.
Mm.
And I wonder if you, this is going to be a weak statement, but you mastered adulthood at such a young age that now you can play around with it a little bit.
Perhaps. I like to think that I'm never going to grow up, though, honestly. I guess I see your point. Like, I had to grow up, support myself, whatever, from 15 till now. I had to grow up maybe a little earlier, but also it's like I don't ever really want to lose, like, that childlike spark that I think that we all kind of look back and be like, dang, I wish I was like that.
But you built in the necessities to at least making your life function at such a young age that now you know them so clearly that you, like, you fight hard to hold on to that childlike spark because a lot of your childhood was taken from you.
Mm. I can understand that. That makes sense. I will say one of the.
I'm not a psychologist. I'm not like diagnosing that. I'm just saying I'm hearing this. I'm saying at 10 years old, if I had to put myself in a position of seeing my friend get hit on the side of the road, and then lose my mom a few years later, and then at 22, kind of like, I would say my 20s, early 20s were like, late teens, early 20s were the years that like literally had, if I would have experienced pain during that time, like real pain, I don't think I would have processed it because it felt like a year's almost wasted of just bliss in college mm-hmm. and euphoria. Like if those things happen to me, like they happen to you and they dramatically change your course leading up to who we know today. I mean, how old are you now?
28.
28. You're not too far removed from those years.
Pretty old.
I'm 30, so that's cool, man.
I will say one of the most challenging things, well, not the most challenging things, but like I said, I grew up with a lot of kids who had like well-to-do families, basically like security blankets, security nets, right? I guess I always kind of looked around at them too and resented them in a sense where I was like, look, if you fail miserably at whatever you want to do, like reach for the stars, you fail, you have them to lean on, or like they'll support you, they'll put you up, they'll like bring you back into their home and take care of you. If I do that, I'm like going to be living on the streets because I don't have anywhere to go other than wherever I can put myself. You know what I mean? And so for the longest time, I was always like, I don't have a safety net. I don't have anything to do unless I do it now and figure it out. And so I think that's maybe kind of what you're getting at, where I was like, everything was so on me for the longest time, where now I guess I have the ability to be like, okay, I can kind of do whatever I want. And so I'm going to do that, you know?
I completely get it. And I've never thought about that with you, Dean, until now.
Hmm.
I've never have.
It's a good psychoanalysis.
It's the part of this podcast that I enjoy the most, because getting down and hearing your story, I don't know if it allows things to make sense, because afterwards we're going to walk out of here and we're going to still struggle and I'm going to get upset with you because you do lack in your communication now and then, and I don't hear from you for days. Which I still don't know why. And I'm not going to just blame it on the Unglert curse.
But that's the thing. I have no excuses for that type of stuff now. So I would never be like, oh, I'm this way because of, I don't know, genetics or because of the traumatic experiences that I had as a kid. I have no excuse to not be communicative with you.
Other than just you don't like me.
Ben.
But all of it makes sense, which is why this podcast means so much to me. I'm glad I'm doing it with you. Dean, I want to get into what led you to be on The Bachelorette. But before we do, we're going to take a break. Before we come back with Dean, I'm going to take a second. At the end of the podcast, you're going to hear a segment with one of my buddies, Bob Dalton, talking about Sackcloth and Ashes, blanket company giving blankets to people without homes all across the U.S., their partnership with my company, Generous. So make sure you tune in and wait to the end of the podcast. Conversation with myself and Bob Dalton. But until that conversation, I am here with Dean Unglert, a fan favorite from The Bachelorette, Bachelor in Paradise two times over, and Bachelor Winter Games. We've caught up with Dean so far, but now we're getting into the stuff that listeners, you're familiar with. Dean, how do you end up on the show?
Ben, how'd you end up on the show?
Why do you turn this on me? I was signed up through a friend, and then I just went through it with myself, and I kept doing the process after they sent in my first like application. I did a video, and I did all that stuff.
Yeah. The normal way to do it. I guess we can go back to your season of The Bachelor.
Okay.
So we were watching your season. Well, we weren't watching. I never really watched a show before going on it. Did you?
Off and on. Yeah, my mom and I spent time when I'd be home. We loved watching it together. But when I was away, I wouldn't. Hmm. It was just like my thing with her.
Right, which is great. That's a nice little tradition to have. So one of my best friends loved the show. And it was always kind of this thing that we ragged on him for. He would watch it by himself, you know?
Yeah.
But he doesn't like doing things alone. So sometimes he would like rope and coax his friends into watching it with him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time he made me watch Caitlin Bristow's season. Funny enough, I think it was with her one-on-one with Nick. I hadn't watched it again. He was the one that I moved to Los Angeles with. So your season was on, and I remember he made me watch a couple episodes of your season with you, and I was like, wow, man, that Kayla Quinn girl. There's something about her that I just like really adore and admire.
Not surprised.
And so I was working one day at downtown Los Angeles, and my friends were like, dude, there's a casting call in like Rancho Cucamonga, like an hour and a half away. And I didn't have a car at the time, and I was like, I think Kayla was like just maybe announced as The Bachelorette. And I was like, I gotta go. Like, she's my girl. I want to figure this out. Ended up obviously not going. And then JoJo got announced the next day anyway, so it was no big deal.
put that to bed for like a year or something like that. And then a year later, like I'm at work again, and that same friend of mine calls me and he goes, Dean, I'm going to do something and I want you to follow through with it no matter what it is. And what that something was he got me on a phone call with Amy, the producer of this podcast, who we adore so much, who has a great relationship with the show's executive producer. And so Amy and I talked on the phone for like an hour and a half. And she was like, I love your story. I love everything about this. Like, let's figure this out. Let's try to get you on. And then so the next day I received a call from another executive producer, talked to her for like an hour and a half. And she goes, oh my gosh, like this, you're fantastic. Let's get you streamlined through. This is like in February. The show films in March. And I fortunately lived local in Los Angeles. And so they were like, come into the office, meet some of the producers. We'll give you like the psych test. We'll give you the physical. We'll give you the background check. But we need to like do it as quickly as possible because the show starts filming in like a couple weeks. And I was at a point in my life where I was single. My girlfriend and I had broken up a few months prior. We were still on like friendly terms, but obviously it wasn't really going to amount to anything. And so I was like, you know what? Why not? Like, I don't really think I'm going to go on the show. I think they'll find a way to not want me on the show. So I did everything. Things started like progressing, and they were like, every time you get to another step in the process, you're like, is this real? I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Everything happened so fast. And so eventually they were like, yeah, we want you. March 13th is your first day filming. And this was like March 5th when they told me this or something like that. And I go like, are you sure? Like me, is this really like the real Bachelorette? So
it's all like, it is very confusing.
Yeah. Especially for someone that's like, not like, I don't watch the show very often, but I knew about it. I watched like a couple episodes of JoJo season the day before going on to like kind of get an understanding for it a little bit more. But I just like kind of did everything that they told me to do. And every time I went in and talked to them, they're like, yeah, you're great. We think you're fantastic. We would love to have you on. And every time I was like, really? Are you sure? Like me? And then I went on. And yeah, I think pretty public knowledge. I packed to be on the show for like, I expected to be gone night one. Packed like a small duffel bag, backpack, two suits. And I thought that I was gonna go home. I didn't tell any of my friends. I told like three of my best friends, obviously the one that nominated me, one of my roommates, and then like the day before I left, we were having like a barbecue, and I like told my guy friends, I was like, yeah, I'm going on The Bachelorette tomorrow. And no one else knew. And then funny enough, actually, the first day that I was on The Bachelorette was the live show with Rachel, and so like everyone knew right away that I was on the show, but I didn't have my phone for the next 2.5 months. So I couldn't like really talk to anyone about it, but yeah, that's how it happened. My friend just nominated me through Amy, funny enough. And, it turned into be a much bigger thing than I ever expected it to be.
Amy Sugarman, who he's talking about, who helped him also start his new career in podcasting with the Help I Suck at Dating podcast.
Thanks.
So go to your, wherever you listen to iHeart podcast,
Spotify, iHeart.com podcast, iTunes. I don't know.
And I mean, that podcast, Help I Suck at Dating, is fitting because of your time on The Bachelorette and Bachelor in Paradise. Your time on The Bachelorette, I would say, we talked a lot about kind of the pivotal moments of it. Mm. Your time with Rachel did end after Hometowns.
Mm-hmm.
Any residual consequences, good or bad, from that season of The Bachelorette? Do you still have a relationship with Rachel?
Well, first and foremost, I was shocked I got sent home when I did. I was like, because I saw a couple of my good friends at my hometown. They didn't air any of it, unfortunately, but I got to hang out with them after like the night portion with my family a little bit. It was like an emotional time, so like they like let me like have a couple of drinks with my friends to like decompress and unwind a little bit. And I was like talking to them. I was like, you guys, I think she's going to choose me. Like, I'm pretty sure I'm the one. And they're like, wow, man, that's crazy. And like 3 days later, I texted them and I was like, yeah, I guess I'm not the one.
Were you ready to get engaged to Rachel?
I think at the time I don't know. In hindsight, it's easy to say no, that I wasn't ready to get engaged, but it's hard to put myself back in that situation and say one way or the other whether I was or not. Obviously, Rachel made the right choice. She's married to the love of her life, Brian, so it's weird to even like put myself back in that situation at all. But do I have a relationship with Rachel now? Not really. Like, she obviously leads her life, and I live my life. I don't know. What was the next question?
That was it. Do you still have any like any residual things from The Bachelorette? I mean, I feel like your time of The Bachelorette ended, and it's really we know you best through your time on Bachelor in Paradise and Bachelor Winter Games.
I'm more well defined and known for my time in Bachelor in Paradise. And I will say my time on Bachelorette, I mean, it went overarchingly incredibly well. Like, I was with Peter Krause, you know, fan favorite. There were really no negative things that were said about me, which was like, in all honesty, a bad first impression. Mm-hmm. Like, it sucks that the first taste of, like, publicity that I have ever experienced in my life was so overwhelmingly positive. Because then that set me up to be so crushed by any negative publicity that I were to receive later on, which I obviously inevitably did. So
my tagline was the perfect Ben. Yes. You literally can't set yourself up for it. I get it. Any more failure than that.
The perfect Ben. Well, you are a perfect 10, so I guess that makes sense. You know? Yeah. I wonder what mine would have been, you think? Because I didn't live in a van at the time. I was like a normal guy at the time.
I mean, you still to this day, you have an aura and a uniqueness about you that I think would have added some great taglines. And even then, people, like, you have the movie star thing going for you.
I don't know what that means, but I appreciate it. I think it's a compliment.
Yeah, it's a huge compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, at least a minute has it. So, like,
they talked to me about Bachelor for a hot minute, actually.
Would you have done it?
Yes. I said I would. I absolutely would never to not, like, refuse that opportunity. I think I talked to you actually about it a little bit, because we were talking about, like, money and stuff like that. And I just wanted to make sure I was getting a fair value for whatever the role entailed. And when I met with I never met with, like, Fleiss or any of them, but I met with, like, a couple of the executives for, like, NZK, the production team that makes The Bachelor. And I obviously met with the executive producers of the show, like Alon and Bennett and all that kind of stuff. And I'm pretty sure this is all fair to share. I don't really see why it wouldn't be. But we were talking, and this is a post Bachelor in Paradise filming, pre-airing. So they knew that things weren't going to look good for me. But I think they sensed that, like, Peter, something wasn't going to happen with him, which obviously inevitably fell through. I don't know exactly why, but they were talking to me about it, and they were like, yeah, how do you feel about this? And I was like, well, I don't know if I believe in the institution of marriage as much as you need me to. I definitely don't believe in the idea of a diamond engagement ring. I don't want my family to be a part of it at all, because I saw how you guys, like, made it a big ordeal, and I know that they would, like, Dean and Dean's father meet again sort of thing. Like, that would have been a central storyline. I didn't want that. And I said all these things, like, to the executive producers and, like, the studio heads, and they were like, well, that's not really what we want to hear.
Yeah, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
You don't like what the concept's about. You're not into the symbolic ring that is makes the show.
Yeah. And you don't want to be part of this main storyline that we want you for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
But they still, like, it's funny because they have a good way of making you feel like you're still, like, the guy. You know what I mean? Like, I still, after leaving every meeting, I was still like, wow, that went really well.
Yeah. You don't doubt it. They have mastered the art of human.
Yeah.
They know how to direct, communicate, and get people to where they want.
And honestly, like, I didn't want to be The Bachelor, but I would never have said no to the opportunity.
No, you can't. And I mean, you know, today The Bachelor holds very little role in my life. I mean, I still get asked about it every day, and I still do a podcast that is about The Bachelor. Like, so from the outside looking in, it holds a tremendous role in my life. For my day-to-day life, it holds very little, right? I have a girlfriend that is not at all associated with it. She doesn't even know a lot about the show. I live in Denver with nobody that's from The Bachelor around me. Mm-hmm. I haven't gone to a Bachelor event in years. Like, I'm very disconnected at this point.
Yeah.
But I don't regret a second of it because of the people I've met working on the show and outside of the show. And I feel like, and for you too, and tell me if I'm wrong, it's helped us live out our biggest passions. Mm.
Absolutely. I'm incredibly grateful for the time that I had on the show and the things that it's allowed me to be able to do. I remember, like, being a kid when I was in middle school, thinking things like, man, one day I just really want to skydive, or like, I want to scuba dive, or I want to learn how to fly, or I want to travel to Egypt. Like, all these things that I've always wanted to do since a super young age, but I never had the ability to because I was making $40,000 a year, working 50 hours a week, living in Los Angeles, spending $2,000 a month on rent. It's just like, there was no way to save money. And The Bachelor, in some weird, like, in a way that I initially never expected it to, gave me, like, the time to do things. I got to quit my job, the financial freedom to go put the places I wanted to go, and, like, the publicity or notoriety I don't want to say, like, be given things, but, like, to have doors open for you to go places that you never really would have expected to be able to go. You know what I mean?
I want to take a second here and pause, because I'm sensing when we get to this point in the podcast, everything leading up to this conversation about The Bachelor feels so good and real. And then The Bachelor hits, and almost like I feel like it's a little bit weak. It's a little bit more shallow than what I'd want to do with you. But I think there is this, and what we're talking about here, and like we're saying, is The Bachelor, let's legitimize it a little bit. The Bachelor has played a huge role in your life, mm-hmm. like it or not, and it's also allowed you to do and be a fuller version of yourself than you ever dreamed of.
Yes.
So it is important for us to talk about The Bachelor because these things have helped define you for now how many years? How long has it been since you've been on the show?
2.5, I think.
2.5 years of your life in your mid-20s, The Bachelor has been a part of it. Leading up to this, after Rachel's season of Bachelorette, we found you in Bachelor in Paradise. Bachelor in Paradise. This time Bachelor in Paradise helped lead to you now having the Help I Suck at Dating podcast, and I want to know why. Dean, your time on Bachelor in Paradise was not great.
No.
Not the first time around.
Right.
The first time around was hard. There was a lot of things that happened during that season.
Mm-hmm.
That I think affected people's image of you. And I don't believe it's at all why they want you on this in-depth episode, but I think people want to know why. And there's 1,000 questions I could throw at you, like, why did you do it the way you did? And I don't think that would be fair. I want to know, what was it about that season in Bachelor in Paradise that you look back on and that you either regret or that you're proud of, or why did it go so wrong?
Yeah, I guess we can kind of dive into that a little bit. So when you're on The Bachelorette, obviously you're not working, you're not getting paid, but you still have your bills to pay back home. And like I said earlier, I was making $40K a year, living in Los Angeles, a lot of expenses, not a lot of income. I was flat broke by the time I got off Bachelorette. I think I had like $140 in my bank account, and all of my bank, I had a checking and a savings account, $140 across to my name, basically. Didn't own a car, didn't own anything. It's just a weird spot to be in. Like, you're basically starting at zero. And like I said earlier, like, I don't have a safety net or anything like that. So it's like, if I hit zero in my bank account, I am basically on the streets, right? I'm sure I could like find a friend to bring me into their house to let me like couch surf for a little bit, but I don't want to do that. No one wants to do that. And so I was off the show in, let's see, end of May, and beginning of May. Paradise began filming end of May, beginning of June. I don't know about those dates. It's something like that. It's off the show for a month, 3 to 4 weeks, between Bachelorette filming and Bachelor in Paradise filming. And I had to make a decision, go back to work for 3 weeks and then leave again to potentially go to Bachelor in Paradise, or to, I guess I don't really know what the decision was between, but I had to borrow money from my brother. I borrowed a couple $100 to tide me over. But the decision to go to Paradise, and this might sound messed up, it was entirely financial.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, we're going to offer you this much money to come onto a TV show where we're going to feed you, give you drinks and a place to sleep for however long you're here. And I was like, if I'm on that show for 3 days, I have more money in my bank account than I've ever had in my entire life. Absolutely sign me up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to my friends before I left. I was like, yeah, like, I might make $1,000, $2,000 on this show. And they go, you're going to have $2,000 in your bank account? That's crazy. And I go, I know, that's insane. So the motive to go on Bachelor in Paradise, and again, it might sound messed up, was entirely financial,
mm-hmm.
because I needed to find a way to, like, obviously support myself thereafter. And this was before Bachelorette even aired, before I had even ever known that selling things on Instagram was a thing. And I had entirely processed my relationship with Rachel. There was no hindrance going into Bachelor in Paradise or anything that I was holding on to from that first show, Bachelorette, right? I just didn't know what was going to happen. Again, I thought I would go into Bachelor in Paradise, not kiss a single person, not have anyone interested in me, and then leave after a couple of days, exactly how I did going into Bachelorette. And I go into Paradise, hit it off with Christina. Christina's a beautiful girl. At the time, the most, like, beautiful girl I'd ever seen in my entire life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still haven't really had a taste of anything that kind of comes after the fact. So I was, like, head over heels for this girl, solely just because she was so pretty. And we had both were able to, like, bond over our traumatic past and, like, these challenging things that we had to go through as children. And then the shutdown happened, and instead of flying from Mexico to Los Angeles, where I lived at the time, I decided to fly Los Angeles to Kentucky, where Christina lived. And I was just like, yeah, I like this girl. Let's see. I had known her for 3 or 4 days at the time. Let's see if we can like hang out and see if anything goes anywhere. So we fly back to Kentucky, spend a couple days there. Like, I'm head over heels, like, obsessed with this girl. I'm like calling my best friends. I was like, I met the best girl, like the greatest girl in the world. And she is great. She's a great person. Obviously things fell apart later on, but I remember we then decided to drive to Chicago from Lexington to Chicago. It's like a 6-hour drive to meet up with a couple of our friends who lived in Chicago who we wanted to like go out and party with. So we drove up there, we met up with them, partied a little bit, things got a little tense between me and Christina. Like, we went out for the first time to like a club together, and we started to like, it was like our first taste of like our incompatibility, whatever. And so I left that. We left that together. She had to drive back to Lexington, but I flew to Denver to meet up with my friend to drive back to LA. Kind of a long story, weird story. But even to get from Chicago to Denver, I like had to call my friend Iggy. I was like, hey, can I borrow $80 to get this flight from Chicago to Denver? Because that's how broke I was. And I think that drove a lot of insecurity in me as well, because it's like, it's hard to consider yourself like a viable partner when you don't really have enough money to support yourself. You know what I mean? So I think that drove a lot of insecurity through me. And then on my way back from Denver to Los Angeles with my buddy, I got the call saying that Bachelor in Paradise were to kick back up and we would like go back and like resume filming in a couple of days. And again, I was like, great. Like I was going to make like $2,000 or $3,000, and I can go back and make even more than that, which is fantastic. And like things with Christine and I were going fine, but there was this weird, like after that night in Chicago, things didn't really go well. And something just didn't sit right. And I just didn't really feel like a long-term thing. And again, I think that it just stemmed from a lot of insecurities that I possessed at the time and like uncertainty of what the future held. So we go back to Paradise, and I guess even before going to Paradise the first time, obviously I told the producers I was like super interested in meeting Danielle, and they obviously knew that, and they decided to send her in right after the shutdown stopped and the show resumed. And this is the girl that I like held so highly in my eyes. I was like super attracted to her. She seemed like a really interesting person. And then obviously we met on the show, and I was like, wow, this beautiful girl is like super into me in the weirdest way. But she expressed interest in me, but she still like pulled away a lot. And I like for some, like something about the chase, like really like ignited a spark and interest in me. And then meanwhile, Christina obviously and I had this history together because we had just spent a couple of days in Kentucky together in Chicago. And we had known each other for like a week or a couple of weeks at that point. And I don't know. I think that if I could go back and do it differently, I don't know if I would. It's hard to say. Obviously I would. I don't know. I don't think I was ready to be in a relationship at the time, I guess really is what it boils down to. I shouldn't have gone on Bachelor in Paradise because I didn't want to be in a relationship. Like the fact that it was a financial move for me rather than like I want to find someone move for me, I think really kind of f***ed with me a lot. Sorry, language. And that's kind of how I've always been in Los Angeles too. Like I would never go on dates with the intent to have a girlfriend, you know, mm-hmm. like before I went on the TV show, I would never go on dates to like, be like, oh, I wonder if this girl's like a suitable partner for me. You know what I mean? So I've always kind of sucked at dating in that sense. And then to just go on the show and have it like kind of be nationally televised, it was a long time coming, right? Like even throughout Bachelorette, I would get texts from like exes or girls that I went on dates with, not girls I went on dates with, but like a girl I dated. And then even like my ex-girlfriend, they were like, wow, you're getting a lot of like positive attention. And like, that's not really right. Because I just like in a real world setting, I'm not that like focused on one person, you know what I mean?
Do you believe that is the reason that you suck at dating, is because it's hard for you to focus on one person?
It's hard for me to, especially then, I'm getting better at this, but it's hard for me to, I enjoy the good times obviously, but it's hard for me to like want to like stick around through the bad times. Like if you get an argument, I'm like, all right, well, if we're getting in arguments right now, like there's no reason to stick around. I don't see the value in it, you know what I mean? That's something I'm working on, and I think I've actually grown a lot from both the show, the podcast, and just life in general. But at the time, I was like, any whiff of trouble, I'm out. You know, like mm-hmm. there's no point in sticking around if something's difficult. What's the point of it? Mm-hmm. So it was basically me, like Bachelor in Paradise was a more accurate representation of who I was at the time than Bachelorette for me. You know what I mean? And so it was hard, like I said earlier, it was hard to go from that pedestal of like very well-liked contestant to then like very heavily criticized contestant, and rightfully so. Like I should have been criticized. I think I could have handled things obviously much better, but yeah, that was a challenging time. And I think a lot of it too was like it was just everything was so new. Like I had never really had like an open bar to drink as much as I could possibly drink. Mm-hmm. I never had this much attention from two women that were just like way too attractive to be talking to me, you know what I mean? And I think I was just kind of like a weird way, like a kid in a candy store. So I just didn't really have the paradox of choice. It was just like kind of overwhelming me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that whole saga was like pretty taxing on me mentally. And obviously on the two girls as well, but.
So even though all this stuff that's happening, you could watch and say, yeah, this is true. This is happening. This is just my own issues. It was still taxing on you mentally.
Oh, I was like super depressed throughout that whole process. In walks my girlfriend.
Hi, Kaylin.
there was a lot of like depression and anxiety and stress that were going through my head while all that was airing. But again, it was like, it wasn't like unjust. Like it's not that I shouldn't have been receiving that. It was me because I was just acting wrongly. I think a lot of it too is like I said, I would get really drunk when I was on the show. And I think in hindsight, like if I could go back, I would just not drink because I would make a lot more conscious decisions, just better decisions. Even now, like when I was 25 and 26, I was like partying a lot. Now at 28, like I don't really go out ever, you know? Mm-hmm. We went to a party the other day, and that was like the first time we ever really partied together, Kaylin and I, in 4 or 5 months of dating, which I think is great. But like watching that stuff back, I was like, yes, this is me, who I am now. In this moment of life or whatever, in this snapshot of life. And it just like, it wasn't very obviously the best version of myself, you know?
That's one thing that I don't think we've seen out of you through television is you upset. And I think that's the one thing that people probably like want to wring your neck sometimes and be like, you aren't showing any emotion here. There's been moments, but it's quickly moved on from. And I think to hear that this really hurt you or affected you or allowed you to look inward, I think, I don't know, it encourages me as a friend, maybe, but also it hurts because I know that it was just, I mean, that season of life is so confusing because there is 1,000 things coming at you. You're dating people that you never imagined that you'd be dating in your life, right? You're batting way out of your league every time you talk to a woman in paradise or on the show. And then when it comes back and it feels like you're alone in it and everybody's criticizing you, it does get depressing. And to know that that's how it affected you opens my eyes to something I've never seen.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of put myself back in that situation too because it was challenging. And I think that the people that I was surrounded by, like, the people from the show specifically, I hadn't really had the chance to like get to know a lot of people from the show like super well. Like I've gotten to know you over the past 2.5 years. I don't really know how to say this, but like, because I continued to date Christina after Bachelor in Paradise, right? I did a deal for like a short amount of time after the Paradise, but then I called that off because I still had feelings for Christina. The reason I called Christina off the first time was because I like didn't like a lot of the things that I had heard from other people, but then I realized that I shouldn't be upset by those things. And so it was just like this weird bit of confusion that I was constantly in. But throughout Paradise airing, and I don't want to like put Christina on the spot or anything like this, but like there was just no support from this person that I was like trying to invest into and like supposedly cared about me. There was no support from her at any moment throughout those times. Maybe glimpses and very privately, but publicly she was like very critical of me because I don't know exactly why she wanted to play that role, I suppose. And that really took a big toll on me as well, where I was like going through this really challenging time publicly and openly, but then I wasn't really receiving much support on the back end or like behind closed doors. And so that was like a super, it was just a really weird time in my life where I thought that things were supposed to be this way with this person, and like I was like trying to convince myself consistently that like what was happening was normal and it was okay and it was like easy to look past, but then like the more time wore on, I just began to realize that that wasn't normal and it wasn't like right.
It wasn't okay.
Right.
So it leads you to where you're at now. We had a stint on Bachelor Winter Games. You did walk away from Bachelor Winter Games in a relationship with Leslie.
Yeah.
We publicly I was able to be with you in Honduras. At one point. That's ended. And it leads you up to this paradise, this season, which was another shocking twist for Dean Ungler. But here's where I want to sit at for 1 second is all these things that we've talked about leading up to this point have helped me understand you better as a friend. And this season on Paradise helped me understand you better because, yes, from a viewer's perspective, it was entertaining. You going down there, your relationship with Kaylin, you leaving the pain that that caused and going, Dean, you've done it again. Bring on the criticism. Bring on the critics. The charming man is deceitful because charm is deceitful. But the man I knew was missing there, and you came back. Hmm. You're dating her today. Through the years and years that you've been on this show, and now your second time on Paradise and a time on Winter Games and your time on Bachelorette, why did you want to come back for Kaylin?
Why did I want to come back for Kaylin?
What did you learn through those things about the relationships that have failed?
Yeah.
The people that you've lost contact with. I'm assuming at this point Christina and Danielle are no longer a part of your life.
No, they're not.
Rachel, is, we've clarified, is not really a part of your life.
No.
What is it about these relationships publicly that you've dated within that's allowed you to learn enough about who you're looking for, what you're looking for, and what you wanted to say? I'm going to take the risk. It's not going to be easy. I'm going to fly all the way back down to Mexico to pick a girl up off a beach because I need to know something more about her.
Hmm. Yeah, that was an interesting time. To start kind of from the beginning of going to Bachelor, I think I got the call for this Bachelor in Paradise around February. I was in Japan with my friend. They called me. And at the time, I was like, absolutely not. I don't want to be in a relationship right now. Like, I've got these plans to move into a van and focus on myself and, like, explore every avenue of interest that I could possibly have. So, like, Paradise, not going to happen. Unless you, like, pay me more money than you've ever. I literally said, I found out the most money that anyone's ever made on the show, and I requested $1 more than that person made. I said, I'm not doing it for a dollar less than this number.
You are a nurse.
And eventually it came, like, I got laughed at and hung up on, basically.
Yeah.
They called me back a couple of a month or two later, and they're like, okay, have you reconsidered? I go, yes, I'll do it for this much money. Still an exorbitant, ridiculous amount that is just never going to be approved. Hung up on me again. And then eventually I was, like, talking to my friends about it, and they're like, you know what, like, whatever. I think I was talking to Nick about it, actually. He goes, what do you have to lose? Like, you're not like, going to miss out on anything by going down to the beach. It's going to be another fun experience. Just, like, you know yourself better, behave yourself better this time, too. I was like, yeah, I guess I'll give it a go. We'll see what happens. I had grown out, like, my facial, like, my goatee a lot randomly. And I, like, walked the carpet with Wells, and I saw how disgusting my chin hair looked. And so I was like, you know, I'm just going to shave off this little under part of my goatee. Keep the mustache. And then I, like, got to Mexico, and I still had the mustache for the more or less. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to keep this mustache and walk down onto the beach.
And it's also the confidence that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah. No, you're right. I don't know. It's easy to, like, paint a picture of what you expect to happen, but then when you get down there, it's, like, obviously never really going to happen how you expect it to. I thought I was going to be a gimmick. You know, I thought I was going to walk down to the beach and be like, oh, here's Dean back for the fourth time. Like, he's going to hang out for a couple days, maybe, like, kiss someone and then probably go home because he's not taking it seriously. So I walk down and see a lot of people I don't know. But I see, like, obviously Christina, Blake, and Derek, who I'm friends with for the most part, all of them. And then I was like, it's weird being back here. I made a conscious decision to stay sober the whole time, too, just because that's kind of been a downfall of mine through seasons past. And it was if you're ever thinking about going on the show, do not drink alcohol. Just, like, have, like, a glass of wine maybe every once in a while, but, like, the first couple of seasons, I was getting, like, blackout drunk.
Yeah.
Almost every episode. Or almost every day, I mean. Because I just, like, there was nothing really else to do, and I didn't really have much else to do other than that. This time, I didn't drink, and it was the best experience out of all of them by a landslide. And obviously, Kaylin and I go on that first date, and Kaylin and I have a bit of a history, right? Like, she DM'd me before she even went on The Bachelor. And so I knew that there was interest there. I, like, randomly saw her do an interview before I even went down to Paradise of her saying, like, oh, Dean's so attractive. And I was like, wow, this girl really, like, likes me weirdly. Which in hindsight, like, it's, I don't know. I really appreciate the fact that she, like, reached out to me before even going on The Bachelor. Because, like, I think that there's a lot of insecurity that's driven from the fact that, like, sometimes you feel like people are just using you for whatever reason. And I don't know. Anyways, we go on a date. It goes well. The chemistry is there. I didn't expect to like this girl. I thought that we were just going to go on a date. And I was going to be like, yeah, whatever. This girl sucks. Turns out, like, I actually do really like her, and time kind of starts to continue to go on, and I start liking her, but I was, like, so convinced in myself that I was not going to leave that beach in a relationship, and the producers all knew that, too, and Kaylin even knew that, too. I told her every single day. I was like, look, I'm going to break up with you on the last day of The Bachelor in Paradise. Like, just understand that. And she, I think she like said that she understood it, but I think she kind of thought that I was like just joking around. Obviously I wasn't. And then eventually one night, the producers were like, look, man, like you're not taking this seriously. You know, you're going to leave. Kaylin's expressed interest in this other guy who's probably going to come down in the next couple of days. Like, it would probably be smart of you to get out of here now so she can explore that relationship. And I was like, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. And I agree with it because I was, like, again, still convinced that I wasn't going to leave in a relationship. And so I leave. I fly back to San Diego where my van was. And I drive out to Horseshoe Bend and think about things. And when I landed, actually, in San Diego, I texted my producer friend. And I was like, listen, man, I'm, like, really sad. I think I might have made the wrong choice. And he was like, just think about it, like dwell on it for a little bit, process it. He sent me like a full on list of things, like coping ideas of like, go here, think about this, like do this, eat this, like things just like to kind of like put my mind at ease, A, and B, like allow some introspection. And he's like, and then I was like, look, man, like I'm sad. I think I made the wrong decision. He goes, well, hey, listen, obviously for ratings wise, we would love to have you come back on the show. It's up to you, obviously, at the end of the day, if you want to come back on or not. Take the night to sleep on it. Text me in the morning. If you want to come back, we'll book you a plane ticket and we'll fly you back down. So I drive out to Horseshoe Bend, stay there for a couple hours, drive down to Phoenix, book a flight from Phoenix to Los Angeles, wake up the next day. And I was like, you know what? I miss hanging around this person that I spent the past 8 days basically attached at the hip. I don't know if you remember Bachelor in Paradise in its entirety, but this girl was like a piece of Velcro to me. She was stuck on me. Like Elmer Fudd's strongest gripping glue.
Yeah, she wouldn't leave you.
She wouldn't leave me alone. Mm-hmm.
Obsessed, they say.
Yes, they absolutely do say that. And it's accurate. It's accurate. It was hard to go from that eight days, 24 hours a day to being around this person who I like actually genuinely enjoyed hanging. Like it wasn't this weird, like me convincing myself that I enjoyed spending time with this person. It was like, I actually genuinely like enjoyed it. And there wasn't really like many lapses in conversation. And when there was, it felt natural. It felt normal, you know? And then I left and I got to thinking, I was like, well, I could wait until Bachelor in Paradise is done filming and like just text her and like ask her if she has the time to talk to me and like see if we can figure this out off camera. Like there's less risk that way because I'm not putting myself out there so publicly again. But also I knew that she like really liked Connor and she was really interested in meeting him. So I was like, well, like the more I dwelled on it and actually called a couple of my friends, I was like, what should I do? None of them were supportive of me going back, by the way. But I knew that like if I didn't go back, she would have left the beach more likely than not in a relationship with Connor. And then I would be infringing upon that relationship at the time. And it would eventually become public when they left the beach together when the show aired. So I was like, this girl's great. She's going to get swooped up sooner rather than later. If I don't go back now, I'm probably never going to have a chance to see if this would like actually work out. So I fly back. Walked down to the beach, and yeah, obviously things went well for me. But that whole decision process, it wasn't easy, man. Like I talked to like Alex and Mike, some of my best friends, and then I came into the studio and recorded a podcast, talked to Jared, and Jared was actually one of the few that was like super supportive of the idea. And I'm glad I did. It was, I don't know. It wasn't easy. Even like walking back down onto that beach that second time, I was like, I almost like turned around a couple times. I almost like told the producers, I was like, look, you know what? Actually, on second thought, this is a bad idea. Like, let's not do this. But yeah. And, you know, kind of to bring everything full circle, like I'm sick of like running away from all the problems in my life, like all the bad things that happened to me. All I do is like basically either run away from them physically or figuratively in so many ways. And even like living in a van, you could look at as like me literally physically running away from everything that's like important to me or has value in my life. So coming back down to the beach was kind of like a symbolic version of me saying like, look, I'm going to stop running away from these things. I'm going to stop like running away from the good things in my life and figure out exactly what I want to do and where I'm going to go. And I want you to be part of that with me. And I'm grateful I did. I don't think that she's upset that she did either, but it wasn't easy.
What was it about Kaylin? I mean, there's something I've caught on here and I want to tell you if I'm wrong. Every other person you've dated in the Bachelor franchise, you've explained them very first thing has been a physical compliment.
Mm.
Kaylin is obviously gorgeous. It's not a secret to anybody.
Mm-mm.
But with Kaylin, your very first comment to her about her is about who she is as a person. Mm. Do you feel that change in yourself?
what I've experienced in relationships is obviously I think the first thing that brings us to like want to talk to someone is a physical attraction, right? Mm-hmm. Like you see someone at a bar, like even you with Jess, Jess caught your eye on Instagram, right? So you decided to go out of your way to try and find it, get to know her deeper. I don't think that's a bad thing to like be physically attracted to someone off the bat. I think my kind of like Achilles heel in relationships is I kind of let that override my other, I guess, way of thinking. And what I've like slowly began to realize is like I'm this is going to sound kind of silly and maybe a little melodramatic. I'm like probably on the spectrum of asexuality.
Really?
I'm not like motivated by sex.
Yeah.
But like the novelty of like meeting someone new and like seeing if you can like kiss them or hook up with them, like that's exciting to me. But like if I date someone that's just solely beautiful and like the main reason I'm dating them is beauty.
Yeah.
That fades incredibly quickly. And what I've experienced with Kaylin is, yes, she's an incredibly beautiful person, but it's a lot more than that. And, like, I can actually enjoy it. Like, I spend a lot of freaking time with this girl, right? And there are times where I'm like, I need to get out of here. But it takes a lot longer for me to get to that point than it has for anyone in the past. Where, like, I'm running from these relationships. Like, this is pre-Kaylin. I'm running from these relationships. But I feel like I'm running from them because I got into them for the wrong reason. You know, like, for some superficial, shallow reason. And what's nice about obviously my relationship with Kaylin is it goes a little bit deeper than that. And there's like a little bit more of, I guess like banter back and forth that we're able to have. And so, yes, she is a beautiful woman. And I'm very lucky to be able to call her my girlfriend, but it goes a lot deeper than just that physical beauty, which I typically would place ahead or in the past had placed ahead of like a deeper connection, I suppose.
Yeah. The thing with Kaylin is for at least the time being, no pressure on you guys, is that when you do start to feel that, like, I need to get out of here, which I get. I feel that too, right? I love my girlfriend, but it happens.
Yeah.
The interesting part is once you do leave and you can collect your thoughts, there, when I know it's right, is there's an excitement to also go back.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah.
We just spent, like, 9 days together in a row, like, literally every waking moment together and every unwaking moment. Like, we slept, obviously, in the same bed and everything. And I was, like it was yesterday. I was like, dude, I just got to get the hell away from you for a little bit. You know what I mean? So I drove out to Paris. I wanted to skydive all day, but the winds didn't allow me to skydive. So I basically just like kind of hung around, like worked on things, like watched Netflix a little bit, watched football. Then I was like, I'm sorry, language again. But like, I was like, I just want to kind of want to get back and hang out with her. You know what I mean? Which is like, it's a really shitty thing to feel.
And it's a really weird feeling because I haven't felt it many times in my life.
Yeah.
It's like, dang it. Like I think I found something. Yeah. Gosh, I've been really good at running away and feeling like, oh yeah, I can't do this. This is getting annoying. And then all of a sudden you found something that you're like, oh, I kind of like it.
Yeah. And that was the big thing too, where it's like a lot of the reason that I wanted to live in a van was because I wanted to experience not like individuality, but like just like complete freedom in every facet of the word, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the appeal of living in a van expressed, or I thought of it as. Well, that was a weird way to say that sentence. And then so like the idea of a girlfriend kind of is counterintuitive to that same idea. And so that's why I left the beach in the first place, where I was like, look, I have this very clear picture of what I want to be doing for the next 12 months of my life. And that's complete and utter freedom. I want to be able to drive where I want to drive to. I want to be able to skydive where I want to skydive, ski where I want to ski, scuba where I want to scuba, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea of having a girlfriend is only going to hinder that idea. And then so coming back, I think like a lot of my reservations about coming back were like, okay, well, like I'm still not going to be able to do those things. But what's great about Kaylin is she's very like supportive of and encouraging of that. And sometimes she's like, yeah, like I'm going to come along with you on this trip wherever you want to go. But then she also like, tomorrow I leave for Potrero Chico for 2 weeks. And she's like, okay with me going away for 2 weeks. Whether she has the option to not be okay with it or not, maybe is a little bit for debate. But the fact is she like, she's not making me hinder my explorative side of myself. Like, I feel like some relationships kind of reel you back in a little bit. And she's just as keen to get out there and do the things that I want to do for the most part. In terms of at least like going places, she's obviously on board with a lot of that stuff. But it's a little different than past relationships. It's funny, actually, we were just talking the other day, and I can't remember exactly the context that it came up in, but we were talking about I shaved my legs for Halloween. Mm. I dressed up as a beautiful girl for Halloween. Most beautiful girl I've ever seen. Second most beautiful girl I've ever seen. And we were talking about shaving my leg hair. And I was like, yeah, like this leg hair has been with me my entire life. It's been with me through good girlfriends and through bad girlfriends. And I was like, well, I'm just going to shave it off and start over new because, like, I actually like my girlfriend for once. Not for once, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's basically like a fresh start of sorts in a weird leg hair-centric way.
Up to the belly button?
I went about 4 inches down on my thigh. I don't know why I didn't go all the way up, but it just didn't feel right to go all the way up. But, yeah, it was, like, this weird I had never really audibly said, like I like my girlfriend more than I've liked a girlfriend in a long time. You know what I mean? It was just like a weird, I don't know, like I don't think she registered it. I don't think I really registered it. But for me to like say that was just like a weird thing. You know what I mean?
I 100% know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, to like say it and mean it and feel. So the other day somebody asked me with Jessica, my dad did actually. He's like, well, so what's going on there? Like, where is this going to go? I said, Dad, the craziest part about it is like I have so much peace around this relationship. Mm. Like it's exciting for me to say things like I like my girlfriend.
Yeah.
Which hasn't happened many times in my life.
Right.
It's not the only time it's happened. It's not many. But the thing with Jessica is like there is this like enormous amount of peace that follows it that has never been the case.
Right. That's how it is too. And obviously like we have our differences, Kaylin and I. She's a little bit more traditional. I'm a little bit less traditional, of course. But yeah, it's a nice feeling.
Dean, you're in a relationship. Life has changed for you since we were first introduced to you on The Bachelorette. I have a few emails from some of your biggest fans. They're not going to be easy to answer. And then I leave with this in every in-depth episode. We do this. We say, hey, Dean, give us a message to send our listeners out on because we've got to know you through this podcast. And I think everybody sitting around would say, yeah, we've got to know Dean a little bit better today. Agreed? All the heads are shaking. Yeah.
Well, you guys know that about my testicles now, so I guess.
A little bit at least. Dean, this email is from Susan. Susan says, I was wondering how Dean feels about the way Rachel has been talking about Kaylin without even meeting her. Did Kaylin listen to his interview on the Rachel's podcast? What were her thoughts? When does he think the two will ever meet?
Kaylin and Rachel have met. I don't know. I don't really want to have much of an opinion on this. I don't think
you don't need to.
I don't need to? Okay, cool.
If you don't want to, you don't need to.
I think my girlfriend's great, and I think that's really all that matters as it pertains to the relationship. And I think Rachel should focus on her relationship.
Next email is from Vanessa, not the Vanessa we know. Back during Colton's season, there was drama surrounding Kaylin sliding into Dean's DMs and not being there for the right reasons. Is it ironic that the next chance she gets to date him, they walk off on the show together? Was this a red flag for Dean, knowing that she was cast for Colton's season while interested in you? Also, the timeline of Kaylin's being in a relationship with Blake doesn't add up because she was in talks to be the potential bachelorette. So if that were true, there's no reason why she would be committed in a committed relationship with Blake, like she told people in Paradise. Was this a red flag for you, Dean?
No, I don't think that really made much sense. Kaylin was cast for Colton's season, yes. I think that you're allowed to have a crush on someone, and then also you're allowed to go and date someone else, too. I don't think there's much issue with that. I will say, I'm going to speak on Kaylin's behalf, she wanted Jason Tardik to be the Bachelor, and she went on Colton season. I don't think that's an issue either. It's not like I need someone to be like, I've only had eyes for you since the day that I was born. Like, she's a free woman to do what she wants. It's like, the Blake stuff, man, that stuff's been beaten like a dead horse. Like, a dead horse? Is it like a dead horse? It's been beaten to death. And I don't think we really need to talk about that anymore.
I would agree. So here's the truth to it. So in summary, Dean and Kaylin are together. Things are going well.
Those were the hard emails you were telling me about? I feel like there has to be something harder than that.
No, that's pretty hard. Especially hard because Kaylin's in the room.
I know. I know, you're right.
Okay, Dean, this is the end of the in-depth episode. One that we were very thankful that you came on. Thank you, first off, for coming on here and sharing who you are with us, allowing us to fill in the gaps of where we might have missed it during your time on The Bachelor. I think, hopefully, and tell me if I'm wrong, these podcasts help give a clearer picture of who Dean is.
Yeah, what's funny about podcasts to me is I don't always listen to them back, but sometimes I listen back to a podcast that either I was on or a friend of mine was on, and I'll always like look back and be like, well, I wish we would have dived into this a little bit deeper or went down this alley a little bit longer kind of thing. And I'm sure like if I listen to this podcast back, I might obviously not because it's kind of embarrassing for me in a lot of ways. I hope that I don't feel that way. I don't expect to.
whenever you like think about your story to yourself, and for whatever reason you're doing it, you always like kind of plan the things that you want to talk about and like what you want to touch on. And so I feel like obviously conversation flows, ebbs and flows, and doesn't necessarily allow that at all times. But I think that this was really good. And I think that you did a great job of navigating the conversation. You got the ball story out of me for the first time in public that's ever happened.
That's big.
That's a big one. And big one. I thought about every platform that I would have had to share that story.
This
I never expected it to be this, but you did a fantastic job. You made me feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You made me feel like I was at home, so I appreciate that. But
is there anything right now that you do look back on during this and you're like, I wish we would have gone deeper?
I'm grateful that we didn't go deeper on Bachelor Winter Games. I'm grateful that the thing about all these stories, right, is that they're whatever I say, whatever story I share, it's never going to be the full truth.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I think it is or not, it's never going to be 100% accurate. And so it just doesn't necessarily make sense to kind of go into a lot of like the he said, she said type of stuff because it's never going to be right. And so I appreciate that we didn't dwell on that stuff for very long because my experience with Bachelor in Paradise is my experience. And everyone else's is everyone else's. So it's just like, it's kind of a challenging thing to navigate when you want to open up about it. And like, I don't want to put anyone on blast ever either. So like, while you're trying to be respectful of their privacy, you also want to like share your side of the story, even though you know that that's maybe not exact. Like if you were to go with a third party objective view to that stuff, like maybe you would see things a little bit differently. So it's just always like a weird challenging dynamic. But I don't think that we could have gone deeper into anything than we did. I am a little upset that we talked a little bit about how there were only a few moments that I were to show emotion during this podcast that you said, because I wanted to show more and I do want to show more. And I obviously, you know, we've gotten there a couple of times as friends, but it's kind of, I guess, hard to be like that performative and be like, let's dive into this and like, let's get super emotional about it, especially when it comes to things like talking about my mother passing away or Hunter or Alex. It's kind of gotten to the point where I've just began to recite like a script in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You explain it enough times, you basically just spit out the facts as quickly as you can, and then you hope to move on to the next topic. And this was, it was that, but it was like maybe a more watered down version of that, where we dove a little bit deeper into it, which I appreciate. But I still feel like there were times where I was kind of like going into autopilot mode and just like saying things that I've said 1,000 times. You know what I mean? And so if I were to listen back to this, I would probably be critical of myself for not being more, I guess, like spontaneous with my emotions and like figuring out exactly what might have been causing those like words that I was saying, you know?
And I don't know how to respond to that because I feel like it is one of the detriments to doing having a public life at any level is you get asked about the things that have been most pivotal in your story. Like a mother passing or a best friend passing. And you get asked about it so consistently.
Mm.
Even today, like, different thing. But for me, some pivotal points in my life are my times in Honduras and, like, my relationship with Lauren. I just did a press tour today, and I was asked about Lauren getting married on every single one of my stops. Like, that's my ex,
mm-hmm.
who I spent 2 years of my life with, who, like, has held a big piece of my heart for a while. Or your mother, who has a huge role in your life, but you talk about it so consistently that you become numb to the answers, and it does become routine, and it's scary.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary, but it's also healthy because I know that in my own time, there is a deep sensitivity and caring for those moments, mm-hmm. that like I can't highlight publicly because I turn into a robot.
Right. Well, and also think about it this way, like in my case, what would it be like if every time someone asked me to talk about my mother, like I broke down and started crying? You know what I mean? Like that just doesn't really seem healthy. I don't know, but maybe it is. Maybe it's not. I don't know. I don't know exactly. It's like you said, you kind of become numb to it and you just basically recite the things that you've learned to recite just so you can kind of either A, get off a topic you're uncomfortable talking about and move on to something else, or for whatever other reason. I don't know.
Dean, close out here. 30-second message to our listeners. Before we do, Ashley has written some rapid-fire questions for you. We're going to bring on Bob Dalton at the end of the podcast. But 30-second message to our listeners of who you're becoming, who you want to be, and how they can live their best life.
Ooh, wow. Best life. That's a good one. Who am I becoming? I think every day I grow to hopefully become a better version of myself. I don't really know. This is kind of a weird 30-second segment. If you're listening to this, be sure to listen to Help I Suck at Dating on iHeartRadio.
Also, if you're listening to this, a big thing that people reach out to me often about on Instagram is about the traveling that I do. And I think that I've learned a lot about myself through the travels that I've done, both by myself and with friends and significant others. And if you're ever questioning whether you should do something along those lines, I fully support it and encourage you to do it because I've learned a lot about myself. I've gained, I would say almost all of the confidence I have nowadays is just through traveling, especially as of lately, by myself with my friends. And it's an invaluable experience and it's incredibly fun. Be sure to check out my website, www.deanybabies.com. I'm writing about my travels a little bit more. And I want to be able to share with you kind of like the nitty gritty side of traveling, not really like the puffed up, like I share about my costs and my planning and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of want to shed some light on that side of things to hopefully allow you to understand it better, to be able to do it yourself, because it's changed me a lot as a human. So that's it.
So where can they find the blog?
DeanyBabies.com.
DeanyBabies.com. Coming at you, Dean, send us out here. Ashley's rapid fire questions. TV show you're loving right now.
Oh, Living With Yourself.
You can only have one of these, toothpaste, floss, soap. Which one do you pick?
Oh, man. Toothpaste.
Artist you want to have play at your wedding?
Oh, John Craigie.
Good choice. Wow, I didn't know. I just saw him live.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Love John Craigie.
Oh, I'm super jealous.
Yeah. I like that about you. Hey, celebrity crush.
Kaylin Miller Keys.
Can't choose her.
Oh, Jamie Chung.
Not surprised. Jared or Nick?
Jared and Nick. I don't know. Ben. That's a messed up question.
Come on. That is. You can only listen to one of these bands forever. Which one do you pick? NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, or Jonas Brothers?
I'll go deaf. Thank you very much.
And this one is easy. Which one would you rather give up, drinking or traveling?
Drinking.
Dean Unglert, everybody. It's holiday season. We're up and flying. We're driving. We're planes, trains, automobiles, walking. I don't know what you want to do. You can do a lot of things during your travel, but make sure you got a bag to go with it. Away luggage. This luggage is for modern travel. Away luggage is the perfect suitcase with all the features that make travel easier. We are constantly traveling, and the perfect luggage is so important. You just heard Dean. He is now picking up, and he's going to Mexico for 2 weeks. I'm on a flight again tomorrow. Things happen in life that you got to move and groove in today's world. And in a sense, your luggage is your home on the road. You get a 100-day trial on everything Away makes. Take it out on the road and live with it. Travel with it. If you decide it's not for you, you can return any non-personalized item for a full refund. Free shipping on any Away order within the contiguous U.S., Europe, and Australia. It makes the perfect gift. I'm taking the carry-on to Napa Valley, this weekend. A lightweight and durable shell that's made to last for a lifetime of travel. Four 360-degree spinner wheels guaranteed a smooth ride. TSA-approved combination locks keep your belongings safe. An optional ejectable battery to keep your phone charged. A removable laundry bag to separate dirty clothes from clean clothes. The Away suitcase is designed to last a lifetime, and that matters to me. I want something that is durable and great quality, and if anything breaks, the Away customer service team will have it fixed or replaced. You can visit the Away stores in New York, Austin, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, and London. Listen up. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/famous and use promo code FAMOUS during checkout. Again, for $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/famous and use promo code FAMOUS during checkout. You heard us talk about it many times before. Just for a little reminder, 2 years ago, I started on a journey with a few of my buddies starting a company called Generous International. I'm not going to bore you with it because if you're a fan of the show, you've probably heard it many times before, but Generous sells coffee, t-shirts, bracelets, mugs, other products with stories behind them. And then we donate the profits, 100% of them, back to nonprofits, social causes, et cetera, that are making life change in the world. So it's fighting human injustice that are affecting humans. And here, right now, we are partnering with a campaign with Sackcloth and Ashes. Sackcloth and Ashes is a blanket company that is a give one How would you explain that, Bob? Buy one, give one model? Is that what you call that?
Buy one, give one local.
Local model. We're partnering Sackcloth and Ashes because for every blanket you buy between October 26th through October 30th, a blanket will be donated to your local homeless shelter along with you'll receive a 12-ounce bag of coffee and 25% of the proceeds will be donated to the L.A. Mission. And right now, my good buddy, one of my greatest friends, one of my newest friends, Bob Dalton is in studio talking to us about the campaign right now. Bob, obviously I know the story behind Sackcloth and Ashes, but for the listeners out there that do not, why was Sackcloth started?
Yeah, so I launched the company 5 years ago, and it was inspired by my mom, who ended up living on the streets for a short period of time. And it completely changed my paradigm of how I view and understand homelessness, because I was always the guy that would drive by people on the street and whisper under my breath, go get a job. And she ended up in that situation, and it changed my paradigm because she has two college degrees. She raised my sister and I by herself. She's the hardest working woman I know. And so the idea that she would end up in that situation, it inspired me to call my local homeless shelters and ask what they needed, and they all said blankets. And I was familiar with the one-for-one model, but I felt like the evolution to the one-for-one model was to evolve it and make it local. Mm-hmm. And giving people all around the United States an opportunity to make a difference down the street from where they live. And so I came up with the idea that for every blanket purchased, we'll donate a blanket to that person's local homeless shelter. So if you live in Austin, Texas, and you buy a blanket, we'll send a blanket to a homeless shelter in Austin. If you live in Nashville, Tennessee, and you buy a blanket, we'll send a blanket to a shelter in Nashville. And the whole concept was, let's empower people to make a difference in their local communities to help an issue that is in all of our backyards.
You actually brought in, I think, two blankets for Mark and Easton today. You want to pass those out real quick?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Check these out as we're talking. We're passing out the blankets right now for Mark and Easton to take home, keep, cuddle up with tonight with their lovely wives. Easton has the biggest smile on his face. There's not one man that loves getting gifts more than Easton. Bob, as they open up these gifts here, I want to talk to you a little bit. Then you see a need. You hear a need from the local shelters. You start this blanket company. And then what is the story of Sackcloth and Ashes been? Because that's where it starts. But it's definitely not... there's a lot that's happened to get you to this place where you are now.
Yeah, so the quick overview is I launched the company with a sewing machine and a roll of fabric from Joann's Fabric. And shout out to Joann's. I still get the discount codes on my phone. And I realized really quickly that I can't sew. And so I found a lady in my community that could sew. She started making me blankets. I'd box them up, started driving up and down the Oregon coast and getting into as many shops as I could. And my only business strategy was post on Instagram once a day. So I'm posting on Instagram. This is back in 2014 when Instagram was just at the early stages of kind of at the bottom of the wave. November of 2014, 5 months into business, Instagram emailed me and they're like, Bob, we love your story. We love what you're doing. We want to feature you on Instagram's Instagram account. And that was kind of our Kickstarter. That was our big break as a company. They post about us. We go out to 42 million people and we grew like 20,000 followers overnight. Ultimately, what that did was it gave us the ability to work with pretty much any content creator on Instagram. So there was a time like 2014, 2015, I was working with over 100 influencers at one time and just built the brand on social media for the first 4 years. 2018, we launched our first major campaign called Blanket the United States, where our goal is to donate 1 million blankets to homeless shelters by 2024. And we're going to do that by partnering with people individually who buy a blanket from our website. We'll send a blanket to their local homeless shelter. And we're going to do that by partnering with companies that want to give gifts to their employees or their customers. They can now give a blanket as a gift and make a difference in their local homeless shelter. So it's answering a huge question for tons of corporations around the United States that are like, how can we make a difference in our local communities? You can now give a blanket as a gift and make a difference in your local community. So what that's done is it's opened up the door for us to work with organizations all around the United States and partner with people like Ben to run specific awareness campaigns to bring exposure and light to organizations that are actually doing really good work on a grassroots level.
It's, you know, for anybody out there listening, Sackcloth and Ashes has quickly become one of the most prominent for-purpose companies in the U.S. And obviously Generous is working really hard to continue to do good as well. You know, for somebody like Sackcloth and Ashes, You have a platform, you have a product, things are going well. Why do you partner with a company like Generous?
I just had a lot of respect for you personally because, you know, anybody that gains following really quick, it's really fascinating to see what they ultimately do with that platform. And I had a lot of respect for you because you actually use your platform to start something from the ground up. And, you know, I just have respect for anybody that's out there trying to start something from the ground up. Entrepreneurship is incredibly difficult and 80% of the time doesn't work out. So the fact that you used the platform that you had to actually start something from the ground up and specifically start something from the ground up that actually is making a difference, that's what really drew me to what you're doing. And, you know, I'm a fan. I'm a supporter of anybody out there that's actually showing up and trying to make stuff happen like that. And so, yeah, it's been a privilege to be able to partner with you and Generous and being able to do this specific campaign.
Yeah, well, it sounds like I just teed myself up for a really nice compliment there. I think Bob and I have gotten along really well because I think Generous's mission to donate profits back to and kind of be the engine that fuels nonprofits that are trying to make life change, and Sackcloth and Ashes, a mission to blank the U.S. and to help people without homes feel known, be loved, and have that blanket. As we close out here, Bob, you said something this morning as we had coffee that I think it really hits home for me, because blankets are so much more than just a material item to have in the whole. Why was blankets and why has been blankets been so important to you?
Yeah, we kind of hit the jackpot with blankets just because blankets is a universal product. Everybody has blankets. Everybody deserves to have a blanket. And blankets are an item of dignity and comfort, you know. And beyond that, ultimately, blankets have become a third-party object that's connecting me with people that have incredible amount of resources and influence and companies that have influence and connecting me with the organizations on a ground level that are showing up every single day and actually doing the work on a grassroots level. And I get to be the bridge builder. The blankets become the connector where I actually get to have conversations with these people that have resources and have a platform to bring exposure and resources to the people that actually need it right now. And the more that we focus on issues in our society and in our media, the more issues we create, the more that we focus on solutions, the better society we create. Mm-hmm. And so the blankets ultimately are creating an opportunity for me to be able to use my platform and invite other people to use their platform to highlight solutions that are being created all around the United States that are doing good work to help solve and bring some aid to the issue of homelessness.
So in summary, here's what's happening. October 26th through the 30th, and we'll probably let it run out a little bit longer. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, it's the 31st, that's okay. You can still play. Type in the code GENEROUS when you purchase a blanket online at sackclothandashes.com. With that, your local homeless shelter will receive a blanket. Along with you will receive a bag of Generous coffee. And then the LA Mission is going to receive 25% of the proceeds from this campaign. We've talked about it before, and I want to say it again. The only heroes in this are the consumers. And so you have to purchase to make this campaign successful. It's the holiday season. These are great holiday gifts. We're excited to be doing this together. And thank you to iHeart for letting us come on and talk about it. And also thanks to iHeart for helping set up kind of the press tour today. It's been a great day. And I am so excited to be able to partner with people like Bob and his team at Sackcloth and Ashes, along with Generous, to make some life change happen, and we're excited to do it with you all. So, again, that's sackclothandashes.com. Type in the code GENEROUS.
Follow the Ben and Ashley I, Almost Famous podcast on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.